Coming up later today on KBOO. At 7:30, Ani and Melody host Positively Revolting Talk Radio. Their topics include upcoming Iran Forum, Bomb or Path Out of Crisis. They'll also speak with Dan Hendelman of Copwatch about recent police killing of James Chassie Jr. and the upcoming memorial service for him. At 9, on the Friday radio zine, Martha Odom speaks with anarcho-primitivist writer Derek Jensen. His latest book is a two-volume set called Endgame.
And at 10, Aaron Yankee interviews Jason Renault of the Mental Health Association and Tom Antoine of the local Mental Health Advisory Board about the James Chassie killing. At 10:30, it's Boneheads and Bigots with Pat McGuire. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman.
Please help out your local community and become part of the KBOO AM News team. To learn how to edit, engineer, or anchor the news, please contact us, Kathleen Stevenson, at 503-231-8032, extension 202, or jot an email, amnews@kboo.org. You've been listening to KBOO, your non-corporate, listener-supported radio station in Cascadia. We hit the airwaves at 90.7 FM Portland, 100.7 FM Corvallis on translator K264AA, and 91.9 FM Hood River on K220HR worldwide on our website at kboo.fm. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.
Music from Iran, Iraq, and Turkey will be performed live at Jammin' for Peace on Saturday, October 28th. Musicians from Iran and Iraq will be joined by Jewish-American musicians, all emphasizing that peace among peoples endures regardless of their government's warring interests. Musicians featured include Iraqi musician and composer Rahim Alhaj, Iranian reed flute performer Hossein Omumi, and Yani Ses, a Seattle-based group of Turkish-American musicians. Jammin' for Peace is happening on Saturday, October 28th, with music from Iran, Iraq, Turkey, and beyond. This all can be found at the First Congregational Church, located at 1126 Southwest Park Avenue in downtown Portland. Tickets are $15 for general admission and $10 for students. KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of this event for peace.
Dr. Nine! I'm back!
Have you secured the media outlet for the 900 Club's inaugural broadcast, Schlichtenstein?
Yes, Doctor. Monday, October 30th at 11 p.m. on KBOO during a radio theater show called The Southern Radio Project.
You diminutive dimwit!
Ow!
Radio theater? Community radio? Monday night at 11? You might as well be answering the Barry Manilow Marathon.
But, Doctor, if your nine wave can penetrate the cultured, independent minds of the KBOO radio theater audience, listeners to enter PRCOM channel stations will be easy pickings.
You're right, Schlichtenstein. This is merely phase one of Plan 9 from Uber Space. The sudden radio broadcast on Monday, October 30th at 11 p.m. will make the Exorcist look like Pippi Longstockings. A Halloween horror show written, produced, and directed by...
That's the fabulous Angélique Kidjo, one of my favorite women. And hey, everybody out there, welcome to Positively Revolting Talk Radio. It's a beautiful Friday morning out there, and it's almost Samhain.
It is that. Good morning, good morning. This is Ani.
I'm Melody.
And together we are, in fact, Positively Revolting. So there's a bunch of stuff going on.
And we hope you all are, too.
And
yes.
Let's
tell you what's going on. In case you missed it, as I did, and I'm so glad it's back because I really want to see it, there's a great movie going to be showing called Left to Die. And it is about the Causeway concentration camp that was left in New Orleans in the wake of Katrina. And this is a film that, excuse me, really, I wish you could see the photo that accompanies it. It's just talk about a picture being worth a thousand words. It basically chronicles the survivors of Katrina and some of the really disturbing things that happened to them. This is made in part by our own Elizabeth Attlee, and it's a great film, and I definitely want to catch it. It's going to be showing at the Clinton Street Theater one night only, Thursday, November 9th at 7 p.m., and that's, of course, at the corner of 26th and Clinton. And then it's also going to be showing at the Baghdad Theater Monday through Wednesday, November 13th through the 15th. And you should call the theater for times for that. And so that's going to be Left to Die, Clinton Street on the 9th, and Baghdad 13th through 15th. And the equally fabulous Danny Dollinger, who some of you may recall has been on our show a number of times and has been in town, is coming back to town. Folk singer, activist, flat picker Danny Dollinger will be here tomorrow night at 7:30. And it's reservation only, so if you'd like to go, it's in Salem. Yes, you have to call 503-378-7704. It's going to be at the Old Central Salem Craftsman, at an Old Central Salem Craftsman home. It's a house concert. So that's going to be something you don't want to miss. Again, if you would like to go, it's tomorrow night at 7:30. For reservations, call 503-378-7704.
Danny Dollinger, one of my favorite guys. So, also, this weekend is the forum and jammin' events looking at our relationship with Iran. So there are a few events going on, co-sponsored by American-Iranian Friendship Council, Middle Eastern Studies Center at PSU, the Andeshe Center, American Friends Service Committee, and many, many others. Let's just do it one day at a time. So tomorrow night, Saturday night from 7 to 10 p.m., is a musical event, Jamming for Peace, music from Iran, Iraq, Turkey, and beyond.
Ooh, that sounds excellent.
It's tomorrow night, First Congregational Church. First Congregational Church is 11th and Southwest, I'm sorry, the 1100 block of Southwest Park.
A different place entirely.
Yep. Yep, I always get those two mixed up. What can I do?
Ooh. It's Teresa.
So that's.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, 1126 Southwest Park Avenue. Tickets are on sale online at aifcpdx.org.
Wow, that's a mouthful.
I know it is. Try America, you know, it stands for that ever popular American Iranian Friendship Council. aifcpdx.org, or by phone at 1-877-278-4842. I will leave this at the front desk. You can call in and get that information. This does sound like a great event. In the 80s, Iran and Iraq were at war for 8 years. Excuse me. And hundreds of thousands of people from both sides became victims of a devastating struggle. The significance of this concert is that master musicians from Iran and Iraq will join Jewish Americans and others to perform for peace, emphasizing the fact that people are at peace with each other, regardless of what our governments are doing in our names. So there will be musicians, since it's a concert. The musicians are Rahim Al-Haj. He's an Iraqi oud musician. Hossein Amami, who's an Iranian ne player. That's the reed flute, which I love so much. There is a Yeni Ses, which means new voice, which is a quartet, it looks like, of Turkish and American musicians. And Honorary Master of Ceremony, Diana Abu-Jabbar, author and, of the book The Crescent, Arabian Jazz in the Language of Baklava. She teaches
the language
PSU.
Of baklava.
The language of baklava.
The only language I've ever known about baklava was yummy. That sounds like
common.
A very interesting book. Sounds like a very interesting evening.
So that's tomorrow night, Saturday night, and then on Sunday there is the informational forum. The informational forum is at 2 p.m. at the First Congregational. I'm sorry, this is at the other church, the First Unitarian Church at the Salmon Street Sanctuary. So that's Sunday at 2 o'clock. You can hear opinions, talks, discussions, with Dr. Darius Rajali, professor of political science at Reed College, author of Torture and Modernity, Self, Society, and State in Modern Iran, Torture and Democracy, and Approaches to Violence, as well as numerous articles. He's the 2003 recipient of Scholar of Vision. Dr. Darius Rajali is, in fact, just renowned in this field.
Torture and democracy aren't two words you hear in the same sentence very often.
He's an interesting professor, and in fact, one of the most renowned authorities on torture worldwide, and he's here in our own backyard. So here, him and William Beeman, author of The Great Satan Versus the Mad Mullahs, How United States and Iran Demonize Each Other. Mr. Beeman is a professor of anthropology and director of Middle East Studies at Brown University. And many others. Sahela Vadadi, a human rights advocate and researcher who is passionately involved in the Iranian democracy movement in general and women's struggle in particular. She frequently writes about the women's movement in Iran. Rostam Prezal, has been a journalist and human rights activist in D.C. He currently heads up the U.S. branch of Campaign Against Sanctions and Military Intervention in Iran. Otherwise, you can find information on them as campaigniran.org.
So there's a whole weekend mapped out for you.
But wait, there's more. And also on this panel will be Polo, author of Talking Stories from the Asian Reporter. Rono Latang Sayang Catalani. Polo is a civil rights attorney and community activist. He also writes for Oregon Public Radio and WUWM in Wisconsin. Polo has lived in Iran as a research graduate in the late 70s. So that's all Sunday afternoon, 2 o'clock, First Unitarian Church. That's Salmon Street Sanctuary at 12th and Salmon in downtown Portland. And tomorrow night, a concert at the First Congregational Church, 1126 Southwest Park, and that is at 7 o'clock tomorrow night. For more information on both of these events, check out the website AIFCPDX. It stands for American Iranian Friendship Council, PDX.org.
See, that's one of the untold benefits of being a member of KABU, or even a listener, is that you don't have to plan your social life. We just, we lay it all out for you in the announcements in the community
calendar.
But
if you're a listener, you owe it to yourself and your community to become
a member. That's right.
But, we'll talk about that in a minute. The other announcement that Melody and I would love to make, just to let you know what's coming up a little bit more on our show, we do have Dan Handelman from Portland Cop Watch. He will be joining us at 8 o'clock. And we will be talking about what's happening with police, most especially looking at the most recent case in Portland with James Chassie. Then also, let's look at what's been happening sort of on a little broader scope than that, because it's been a pretty bleak picture for the last 6 months here.
Haven't we been having this same show for the past 12 years about the police?
Yes, so that's the other
part
that we
want to
talk
about. Seems like major
deja vu. How do we get this moving to stop police violence within our communities?
It seems to me we've been having Dan on for a long time talking about how the police are shooting people, and they keep doing it.
Well, now they're beating people to death instead. So there you have it. Before 8 o'clock, however, Melody and I would like to spend a few minutes talking with you about a really big upcoming event.
The turn of the wheel of the year, and that, of course, is Samhain, otherwise known as Halloween, Hallowmas, All Souls Day, you know, Trick or Treat, Candy Fest, however you celebrate it, which is coming up on Tuesday. And
it's the night of the Great Pumpkin.
Yes, it is. And the Great Pumpkin has already landed at my house. Somebody, the Great Pumpkin's the chauffeur showed up last night very unexpectedly at my house with a giant carved pumpkin. And I was quite impressed. Somehow I managed to get myself on the Great Pumpkin's delivery list. I was very happy about that. And I hope that the Great Pumpkin visits you as well. So, yes, as many of you know who are regular listeners, we are witches, of course. And every year on the high holidays, we do try to talk a little bit about them and their relevance to politics and the rest of our lives. And Samhain, of course, is the Celtic New Year, which has been transmogrified over the centuries into Halloween in this country. And, you know, it's a fun time to dress up and hand out candy and scare people. But in ancient times, it was the festival of the dead when the Celts would open up the family tomb and bring out the skulls of their ancestors, set a place for them at the table, and light candles and set the skulls there and have a feast with their ancestors, honoring their beloved dead. And this, they perceive this as the end of the year and the next 6 weeks between now and winter solstice, when the sun is born again, as the time of lying fallow, in a sense, that this is the time when everybody was snug in their houses and ate the stored food that they hopefully had harvested during the harvest. And, you know, like seeds underground, they lay fallow and weathered the storm and went inward and waited for the sun to be born again, and then the year would begin anew. And shortly thereafter, on the next 6 weeks later, on the Festival of Light, which was Bridget, or
the other direction.
Well, it's Lucia is another yes, another culture's name for it. When the light begins again, that would be the time of initiation. So from now until the winter solstice, was the time when you went inward, you did inner work, maybe did some soul searching and sort of cocooned, as we like to call it now in the 21st, yuppie, 21st century yuppie lexicon. But, it's that time of year, and it's also a time of letting go, a time of releasing all the things that you've carried with you during this year and perhaps for longer, and it's time to release them and leave them behind as the wheel turns and the year begins anew.
Indeed, that
and to honor your dead, and to maybe not to maybe to think about your own death and death in general, and you know, what's going to die in your life and what's not going to die.
It is a time to reflect on cycles. Every time the wheel turns, if you are a longtime listener of this program, then you know that Melody and I like to visit and revisit the quarter and cross quarter pagan holidays. This is definitely one of my favorite turnings in the year. It's the time when things are laid bare.
That's right.
That's how, sort of how I like to look at it. And when you I don't know, in the way I look at things, there is
through your audio glasses.
Image. Yes, through this rather blended bifocal. I see, you know, that cycles sort of have this double spiral effect. So we are now on the inward turn of the spiral. That's the going inward, the searching, the laying yourself bare so that you know what you can heal, what needs renewing, and you can be about the business of doing it in this season, when basically, you know, the energy, the currents, the vibe support that kind of activity. You can try doing it in the summer, but you're going against, you know, the current, and it just takes more energy. So this is the time where the inward flow is supported.
That's right. And as I said, you know, as a seed lies fallow under the earth, it is a good time to to take some time to maybe do some meditation or some thinking about, well, of course, the elections are coming up, and some hard thinking about, you know, decisions that you want to make. Where do you want, what kind of world do you want to live in? What kind of, how do you want to participate in it? What kind of a world citizen and participant in your community and your family and circle of friends do you want to be? And how are you going to live your life accordingly? You know, my birthday is on Monday, and I feel really fortunate to have been born this time of year because, I feel a real strong identification with this and always have. And then as in later life, when I, you know, came to being a witch, it seemed really perfect. And I've always really, enjoyed the winter time, the time of the leaves falling. And as Ani said, the world is laid bare and you can see things for the way they really are. And as opposed to other times of year when, you know, we're busy running around and, you know, there's all kind of life is bursting forth and we're all, you know, have all kinds of things going on and we're distracted by our daily lives and all the things we have to take care of. This is a time when, you know, you can take some time to really think about, what lies behind just the day to day, activities that you do and what life is really about for you. And, as I said, you know, take some time to think about those who've come before you and your family line and, what they have given you, what legacy you're carrying forward and what legacy you'd like to leave, behind as well. And of course that again ties into what's going to happen, on that first Tuesday in November and how, what kind of world we're going to create for ourselves and leave for our children and grandchildren. So, things to ponder on as we approach this Samhain Eve. And if you are going to celebrate this holiday with partying and candy, and there's not a thing wrong with that, it's really fun. But do take some time in the next 6 weeks, if possible, to, as I said, go inward, think about things, and take a good look at yourself, because we all need to do that. The unexamined life is not worth living, as they say, and I have to say I agree with that. So, you know, These things need to be discussed more, I think, in public life. We tend to pretend in America that spiritual life is not really very important. You know, many of us are religious or we go to church or whatever, but we often don't take time to sit down and really give ourselves the space and time to think on spiritual matters or to do things that further our spiritual path that aren't immediately, you know, paying the bills or, you know, getting the kids off to school or, you know, getting the mundane things done that we have to do every day to keep our lives afloat in this economy, in this society. So I think it's a good time to reflect on these things. And I myself really like to light a candle on Samhain evening and, you know, think about my beloved dead, my ancestors, and my pets who have passed on, my friends who have passed on, and honor them because, you know, they're still with us if only in our minds, in our memories, and in some cases, perhaps, in other ways as well. Who knows? I'm sure most people have had the experience of believing that someone who had passed on had visited them in some way or another or communicated with them. So this is a good time to do it. This is the time the Celts believe that at this time of year that the separation, if you will, however you want to put it, between the world that we perceive most readily and the other worlds was at its thinnest, and it was the most optimum time to move between the worlds, so to speak. So if that's something you're inclined to do, now is a good time.
That's right. The veil is thin this time of year, and I think, in fact, it's important to ask the other side. It's important to talk with our ancestors and actually ask them how they might, well, from their rather advantaged perspective, aid us in our current times,
be that
personal, be that political. It's good to get advice. You know, what can you say? I believe that there is strength in the continuity of existence. And
yes.
I think that it is just a good idea. And in fact, a prominent point of most sustainable cultures to honor one's ancestors.
Yes.
And to see ourselves only as sort of this sand in the hourglass and not the be-all and end-all of existence.
Really?
Yeah.
We're not? Well, there's a great song that expresses that.
Honoring the ancestors and welcoming the future generations is a sustainable path. And I find it spiritually fulfilling. So here you are at Samhain. Just wanted to draw folks' attention to that.
Yes.
It is. We've just come out of the dark of the moon. And anyway, that's the cycle we find ourselves in. So we have with us Teresa and Marlene.
Hi.
And, good morning.
Good morning, y'all.
Good morning. What are y'all going to do on Samhain? You going to party and eat candy?
I'll tell you, for me, it's a real important Days of the Dead kind of event. And I have a little altar in my home with a little memorabilia of all of my ancestors, pets, and human who have passed on,
right.
Friends, and I make sure there's some candles there and take a little time with them, put a little food out for them. And so that's what I do.
That's awesome. Welcome, Teresa. Welcome, Marlene. You have joined us this morning to help us raise money for KABU.
Heck yeah.
So I have, like, two pieces of exciting news.
Go for it.
I've been out checking. I've been checking around. And it's so it seems that we are $2,199 away from the goal of this fall's pledge drive.
Let's just do it then.
$2,199 away. So, you know, please, let's do that now. The other exciting piece of information is about a matching pledge.
Yes, I've heard about that. And I guess for this show, if I'm understanding it right, we have a $500 matching pledge. So I was just sitting here with a little pencil and paper doing a little math. And, you know, if we had about seven or eight $60 pledges, we would have those matched.
By anonymous.
Yes.
And I would like to thank
and
Mr. and Mrs. Muss.
Muss?
No. Let me be very clear.
No, I'm just
not
joking.
Well, the number to call if you'd like to join is 503-232-8818. I bet you've heard it before. And our pledge drives are longer because our list of corporate donors is non-existent. 1-877-500-KABU for those of you in Washington State or in Salem and places like that. You know, Melody was talking about seeds in the ground, and it would be a great thing for you to plant the seed of your cooperation and participation. I'm having trouble with syllables this morning. Participation in KABU. And so we want all you punkins to call because it would be a good thing to do.
Now, you know, I just have to think that on this last day of the membership drive, there are at least 10 of you who are aficionados of this particular program who have not yet called and who would love to help us make that matching grant.
Maybe it's Mr. and Mrs. Muss.
There you go.
503-232-8818. I know this is possibly information you don't have yet. And I know how excited all of the people that deal with the paperwork at the station are when I do this.
Uh-oh, information is a commodity. No.
For those who are pledging to our program, for a minimum of $100 pledge, I will read your cards. I will, I've decided once again I can make time to read tarot cards for our listeners. After November 15th, I will be available. We can call and schedule that anytime. That's a $100 minimum pledge. I have to say, of my skills, I am fond of my card reading, and I've been told I'm good. So there's I offer it up.
Well, you know, this is pretty exciting. I mean, I really think we could just end it now. When you join, I mean, this
end it
also,
now?
If you've
what?
Been, we could
wait,
just
wait,
end it all.
Wait, and that's not the point of sound at all. No,
well,
no.
Well, we could end the pledge drive more or less. And,
in our lifetimes.
Yeah, we can make that goal, and that would be pretty darn exciting. And that also means for those of you who have been kind of procrastinating, time's running out because I really think we could actually do it. I wanted to point out that when you join KABU, you don't just get a little card. You get a card that gives you discounts. Here's a few examples. Bagel Land will give you a 10% discount. Portland Rain Barrel Company will give you a 10% discount. You can even get a discount on an organic butchered pig. Well, hog, it says. Laurie Sonfeld, who I think is on later today, unless I'm mistaken, will give you a $150 discount if you need to sell your house. Gary Weiner will give you a 15% discount on office visits. He's with Pearl Natural Health. And for that matter, there's a psychologist, Christian Wolf, who'll give you a 25% discount, and he usually charges $110 an hour. This is the sort of thing that you get when you join KBU, and every time you use the discount, you make people happy because they'll say, oh, you're with KBU, and then you have a little, you know, a little solidarity, a little something in common.
There you go. It's nothing like a little solidarity, especially in times like these when we need to, you know, connect with our allies.
And
if you want to do
that,
it's 503-232-8818. Now, we have a couple other ways to say thank you this morning. We have one copy left of the Wee Moon 2007 calendar, you know.
Ooh.
The gals out in Estacada who make this part of how they live is by creating this lovely calendar that so many of us have relied upon over the years. We have one copy for a $75 minimum pledge, one copy left of the Wee Moon 2007 calendar.
So let me just say, that's a cool date book. It's a cool resource. And why it is? Well, there's little inspirational, like, verses and poems and bits of prose and stuff.
Now, when you say calendar, are we talking about the date book wall calendar?
I was talking about a date book. Is that
just
a wall calendar?
Just the date book. I'm sorry.
There is a wall calendar also.
Okay, so you're talking
date
book.
We have the date book.
And the date book, so you see, you get to carry this thing around. You get to, like, write out your appointments. And as you're scheduling your appointments, if you happen to be a fan of trying to figure out where the moon is and that sort of thing, day by day, it's listed for you.
And besides,
so you
it's
can
full
take
of
that
beautiful
into consideration.
Art. Really beautiful art that you can check out. And
it's a cool book.
List out
it's
on.
A good resource.
Now,
so.
We've got another thing coming up. This would be something you could bring a friend to. We have still one pair of tickets left to the Jammin' for Peace concert tomorrow night. This will be a concert featuring musicians from Iraq, Iran, Turkey, as well as a number of Jewish musicians who have come together to show that even when governments create war, people can create peace and beautiful music. This will be tomorrow night at 7 p.m. at the First Congregational Church, and we have one pair of tickets for a $60 minimum pledge. And just think, when you make that pledge today, it will be doubled because we have this $500 matching grant, which means if we bring in $500, someone will match it for us. If we bring in $499, they won't. So we got to bring in $500, and we got to do it in the next hour. So you got to get on the phone and dial 1-877-500-KBOO or 503-232-8818. Ask when you call for a thank you gift of Ani reading the tarot cards for a $100 minimum pledge, or the Jammin' for Peace concert tomorrow night for a $60 minimum pledge, or the Wee Moon date book calendar for a $75 minimum pledge. But the most important thing is to call 503-232-8818.
Not to mention the Boo Bash. Heck, that's coming up.
There you go.
And that's a $60 contribution for a pair of tickets. That's going to be at Holocene, and you don't want to miss it because the Boo Bash, well, it's back from the dead. Boo Bash, $60. You can do it. You can do it. One way to do it is $5 a month. We can take it out of your checking account. That involves a 2-minute call to us at 503-232-8818. 503-232-8818. Followed by 2 minutes of your time. And then we send you a piece of paper, and it's really no big deal, and you won't notice that $5 missing.
Okay.
And, oh, sounds like we're going back to the, or looks like we're going back to programming.
Of course, you may not ever notice anything missing if you're like most people, you don't ever balance your checkbook. But that's,
oh, that's a sad, sad melody. That's a sad, sad thought. Maybe that's for another show.
503-232-8818. Of course you pay attention to things like that. You're our listeners.
When's the last time you balanced your checkbook?
Be realistic. We'll probably wrap it up. This is probably it. So, hey,
yes.
If you haven't got your KBU t-shirt to piss off the conformists in your area yet, this is the time to call 503-232-8818 or 1-877-500-5266.
And call to show your support for Dan Handelman, who has tirelessly worked many, many hours for years and years to serve his community and run Cop Watch.
Welcome,
and
Dan.
Oregon Peace and Justice Works and all that kinds of other things. And he's a great guy, so, you know, he deserves your support, too.
Yeah. Hello?
I don't think your microphone's quite working yet.
Thank you for joining us, and you're almost with us.
Well, you guys
there
just,
you
know, speak on my behalf, and I'll just be...
just leave the semaphores in the corner.
We were just saying, Ani and I were just saying before you arrived that... This is such deja vu. Like, haven't we been having you on for about 10 years now and the same 12. Thing, same show? The cops are beating people and shooting people. And then 6 months later, the cops are beating people and shooting people. This, we seem to have this show over and over.
Right. Well, I've also been on a show saying the U.S. should stop bombing Iraq for the last 15 years.
Yeah.
So,
how about that?
There are some issues that are current with us.
Unfortunately, these are, you know, things that we have been working to change for a long time, and they're not going to change overnight, obviously. But little changes happen here and there, and every once in a while, the American public wakes up and says, hey, wait a minute, this war is garbage. And that's starting to finally happen. We're finally in, like, a solid majority of the country now. People are against the war in Iraq. And so every once in a while, people wake up and say, hey, wait a minute, the police aren't always our friends, and they're not always out here protecting and serving people. I thought that they were always the good guys, but they're not always the good guys. And that's a message that people only tend to get when something happens to them or someone they know. But in this case with Jim Chassis Jr., I think a lot of people were touched by this case because not only did people know Jim, which is a very interesting difference between this case and a lot of other cases, but you know, he was completely unarmed, had no drugs whatsoever in his system, and the police have no means to demonize him the way they have a lot of the people that they've shot and killed in the past, even the unarmed people that they shot in the last few years.
Right, as if having any trace residue of any drugs in one's system, whether you're armed or not, is reasons to or justification for being killed.
I guess I found myself wondering when they said that the grand jury declined to charge the officers. I found myself wondering, what would the police officers in Portland have to do to someone to get charged with police brutality?
Let's back up two steps. I think that's a really good question. But let's back up two steps. First of all, if folks aren't familiar with the murder of James Chassis, that happened mid-September, September 17th.
Yeah.
Dan, do you want to go ahead and just talk about that event? The follow-up question to that is, it's my understanding that no cops have ever been cited for wrongful death.
Okay. The incident happened in Northwest Portland, actually in broad daylight in late afternoon on a Sunday, and the cops said that they saw Jim Chassis kind of running in and out of traffic and acting strangely, and then thought they sent him on his way, and then they said that they saw him urinating in public, which still hasn't been confirmed. The way that they're phrasing it makes it sound like that's not what happened. And they called out to him, and they said that his eyes widened like a frightened deer, and he started running away. So for the cops, they said, oh, somebody's running away. That makes them suspicious that they're committing a crime. So they started running after him, and they ended up tackling him, and the question is whether they were tackling him with some kind of approved police
technique,
thank you, or whether they just sort of fell on him and just started pounding on him. And apparently he tried biting one of them, and they began kicking him, and one officer, who actually is a Multnomah County Sheriff's deputy, started tasering him. And the taser was deployed four times. And for people who don't know, tasers put out 50,000 volts of electricity and are incredibly painful. But the police story is that only one of those times did the taser actually make contact with Jim Chassis' body. I don't know how they would know that, since if you jammed a taser at somebody's body and kept pulling the trigger, it would only leave one set of marks unless you moved it around. So anyway, so they were kicking him in the chest and in the head, according to witnesses, and the medics showed up because he passed out. He went unconscious, so they called for medics, and the medics showed up, and somehow he recuperated enough where the medics said his vital signs were normal, which is very strange. And witnesses at that point said that they saw blood coming out of his mouth, and yet the police officer, and I was just reading his transcript yesterday, said that it was up to him. It was Sergeant Kyle Nice. Maybe not so nice, yeah. And he said, well, you know, they said we could transport him to the hospital. And Sergeant Nice said, well, we have some charges we got to bring against this guy, so we're going to bring him down to the station. And so instead of bringing this guy who had passed out literally from the abuse he'd already taken, was brought to the police, to the jail. And he was booked. And apparently, they put some kind of thing called a spit sock over his head because he had been allegedly spitting at the officers. And can you imagine if you were already frightened, beaten, and in Jim Chassie's case, he was suffering from schizophrenia, and somebody puts like a stocking over your head.
Right.
What that must feel like. So then he was in a jail cell, and a nurse playing Bill Frist, I guess, looked through the window to diagnose him and decided that he had some injuries that should bring him to the hospital, but they weren't so immediately life-threatening that they needed an ambulance. So they put him in the back of a police car. And I'm very confused about the timeline at this point because it seems to have take about half an hour between the time that they noticed that there was something wrong and the time he finally got to the hospital. But somewhere along the line, they realized he'd stopped breathing again. They pulled over their police car, and another bizarre twist in the story, a man came walking along who's a defibrillator salesman.
And what?
I'm surprised you haven't heard this part of this story.
I'm sorry, this sounds like a really bad script for a movie.
I know. And he said, I'm going to go and get a defibrillator from my house. And they brought it in and they hooked it up. And the defibrillator, if the person's not actually suffering from cardiac arrest, which is not what's happening to Jim Chassie,
right.
It says don't use. So
right.
They didn't end up using it. But they tried doing CPR at that point, and then they brought him to the hospital. And by that time, he was dead. And it turned out that the police had broken 16 of his ribs in 26 places, that some of them had splintered and actually driven into his lungs, punctured his lungs.
Is that what caused his death?
That's what caused his death.
Okay, well, I have a couple of questions. Like, first of all, don't police have batons? Why would an officer ever kick anybody when, if they were trying to subdue them, wouldn't they use their baton?
There are so many questions.
Well, I don't think that's actually a good question.
I was going to say, there are so many questions.
The fact that they used a foot, and actually one officer admitted a fist punching somebody in the face, can cause just as much damage as a baton and is, I believe, taught to the police as a method of deadly force, because once you strike somebody in the head, you could kill them. So that's one of the reasons that, you know, we wrote to the district attorney before he went into his secret grand jury proceeding, which, you know, we're hoping that will change someday. And you talk about changes that are made. The last session in the state legislature, they came this close, and I'm holding my fingers to making it so that the grand jury transcripts at least would be made public. But it didn't make it to the House floor, and
yeah,
we can all imagine what that had to do with. But we wrote to the district attorney saying, we believe that, A, by deploying a taser, which is, you know, quote-unquote less lethal force, but has you know, resulted in numerous people's deaths around the country, particularly people who have mental illness or are combative in this way,
mm-hmm.
and that they kicked Mr. Chassie in the head, that the officers knew that they were using deadly force, and therefore you can't call it an accident, which is what the medical examiner
did. Well, yeah, kicking somebody in the head is that's pretty uncalled for.
Breaking 16 ribs 23 times accidentally is kind of that's a hell of a track record.
Oh, but wait, now, didn't one of the officers claim that he tripped and fell on Mr. Chassie, and that's what, how could you possibly break 16 ribs by tripping and falling on someone?
If you were a safe.
Possibly a refrigerator.
Happened to be a safe that had legs.
Yeah.
Perhaps you might do that. He weighed 100 pounds more than Jim Chassie, so maybe he would have, you know, I don't know. I'm not a medical expert. Maybe he would have cracked a couple of ribs, but I don't think you could possibly do that much damage.
Right.
Well, wouldn't you put out your hands to catch yourself? I mean,
speculation.
Yes.
Like, don't even bother.
I know, but
there
I mean, this
so
is the story
glaringly,
that they're telling: is that
right.
He tripped and fell on him. Right? That's how he got his ribs broken.
Well, that's what the police are compiling from the witness testimonies, many of which said that he deliberately tackled him, and the officer himself said that he tripped and flew over Jim Chassie and landed on the pavement, and he didn't even land on the person. The police are taking the bits and pieces of the testimony that they want and making up their own story. And the DA obviously did that too. And the medical examiner did too. And she, I think, is just from the start of this case, I mean, the first outrage past the incident itself was the medical examiner calling this an accident.
Right.
And she said, oh, that has no legal meaning. Don't worry about it. You know, I didn't want to say it was a homicide because the officers didn't mean to do it. And I have already explained to you that I think the officers knew they were using deadly force. Well, that's what the cops told her, because the cops sit around during the autopsy to give her background information for her to help make her determination about what caused the death.
Because parts of the system work together to protect itself.
Yes, and the medical examiner's office is funded by the state police in this state.
Right.
Well, I know, but still, I just can't imagine how someone could draw that conclusion, but that's okay.
They're used to working together. Parts of the system work with each other to protect itself.
I could list a number of cases in which the medical examiner's ruling was meant to deflect the blame off the police.
Let me rephrase that. I can't imagine how somebody who was a person of integrity could draw that conclusion in that circumstance.
Right.
Okay.
So let's go back a couple of steps. Have there been cops that have been successfully prosecuted for wrongful death?
No. There is one officer who, around the country, it's happened. It's true, but not as far as we know in Portland. There's never been an indictment for an on-duty officer's use of force.
Now let's think about that with Portland's track record.
Wow,
that's pretty scary.
Yes, it is.
I mean, think about Dickie Dow, who died almost exactly the same way as Jim Jassy. We think about Kendra James and Jahar Perez.
Well, and think about some of the attempts, like the person who had the 28 shots fired at him as he was fleeing the TriMet bus.
Only three of them hit him.
Yes, but they shot 28 times.
Right, and then that cop was fired, but he was then later reinstated because an arbitrator said the cop was just doing his job. That cop had to reload his pistol. He had to take the clip out and put a new clip in.
Right.
And he was just doing his job, and it was near a school, albeit it was at night, but still.
It's a residential neighborhood.
Yeah, on and on. There's historically quite a number of outrageous cases.
And then there was the don't choke him, smoke him incident.
Right. And again, those officers got fired, and then for the people who don't know what that was.
Right. For folks that haven't been living in Portland for the last 15, 20 years.
First there were the cops themselves who choked a man to death that they thought was a suspect when he was actually a security guard who was trying to keep
subdue
a suspect.
Subdue the actual suspect.
And that guy happened to be African-American, the security guard. And there was an inquest where they recommended that there be an indictment at the grand jury for this, that it was a wrongful death. But the grand jury failed to produce an indictment.
Right.
Perhaps if the cops had been a ham sandwich, they would have gotten an indictment. But,
oh my God.
It's terrible. But that's what they say. A DA can get an indictment on a ham sandwich if they want to, but I don't think they want to.
Right.
They too, like the medical examiner, work with the police every day to prosecute the, quote unquote bad guys.
Right.
And, they don't want to make waves. Now, DA Shrunk's response to that is, we prosecute officers all the time, and we're the harshest critics of the police, and I'd like to, maybe sit down over a cup of tea with him sometimes.
So you're
a harsher critic of the police than we are. Okay.
I find that difficult to believe.
Yeah. Maybe you can get him to write a book report on a volume of the police report that you put out.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens. My concern is overall that Portland Cop Watch is part of a peace group, Peace and Justice Works, and we are trying to connect the way that our federal government uses violence to solve its problems and our local state military, that is the police, enforces the law using violence as well. And until we start making changes at the top where people are learning and young people are learning that this is the way to resolve your problems, we're going to keep having these
absolutely
happen.
There are so many connections. I want to invite listeners to call us and join us this morning, 503-231-8187, if you have questions or comments around police abuse. Given the rather bleak, feeling that I think Melody kind of laid out at the beginning, we've talked about this before. Mm-hmm. What's up?
Over and over.
One of the things I would love to talk about are what can we do to really resolve this? What can we do to bring solutions to cops who are out of control and violent within our communities?
Right. Well, as often as the newspaper I'm about to cite gets its facts wrong, the Portland Mercury actually ran an article yesterday about the crisis intervention team. And according to their calculations, which I haven't had time to double check, it would cost less, let's just say less than $1 million to train every Portland police officer that walks a beat in crisis intervention team training, which is the de-escalation techniques that you use for somebody who is or who may be suffering from a mental crisis.
Shouldn't that be routine for police officers?
Why, yes, it should. And ever since that training was introduced in 1995, we've been jumping up and down and saying, why aren't you training every single officer with this? Chief Sizer's, after this incident, pledged to make sure that all new recruits will get this training. The 40-hour, full 40-hour crisis intervention training. But that still leaves whoever's on the force before that who hasn't been trained. One out of every five officers has this training at this point.
Well, wouldn't that be sort of counterproductive if the superior officer on the scene didn't have the training and the rookie did?
I think so.
Because wouldn't the superior officer be in charge and, you know?
Well, depends how the situation is going down. But yeah, it's possible that the officer who wasn't trained would say, what are you doing talking to this guy? Let's just taser him.
Exactly.
Right. I believe we have... Nope.
All right, well, we haven't talked yet about what's happening tonight, which is we've been working with the Chassis family and with the Mental Health Association of Portland on a memorial vigil for James Chassis Jr. And as I said, many, many people knew him. So his families wanted to get the message across that he was a very peaceful guy, and that that even though it's understandable that the community has a lot of anger about what's happened, that the main thing for us to do is stay positive and focused on the kinds of things that Jim Chassis kind of believed in.
Right.
And so the memorial vigil is called Love One Another, and the idea is it's a remembrance of Jim Chassis Jr., and it's a positive reaffirmation of his life and things that we can do for a positive change. And so it's tonight at the First Congregational Church downtown, same place that concert's happening tomorrow.
It's a hotbed of activity.
It is. Friday, October 27th, that's tonight, 7 p.m. at 1126 Southwest Park.
And, you know, as Dan was saying, a lot of people knew Jim, and I'll go ahead and fully disclose, we went to high school together, you know, and he was a good friend of mine in my senior year of MLC in 83. And, again, you know, talking about somebody who really advocated loving each other and peaceful resolutions. That was what he was all about.
Mm.
And I just, you know, again, for him to come to this end,
that's very
brings
ironic.
It home to me that this is any of us.
Mm-hmm.
Any of us.
Yeah, right.
And that's one of the reasons why I'm really hoping we can use this case to focus as much outrage into action and organized, sustained change as we possibly can.
Yeah.
And if there's ever any good to come of tragedy, let this be the time that we actually move together to get effective police controls.
Right. Well, and let me say that Chief Sizer's pledge to train the new officers in crisis intervention, that's a good thing. The mayor's pledge to look at how police interact with the mentally ill, that's a good thing. But you know what? The question on the floor is police violence.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Why do police use so much violence? And how do people end up dead with 16 fractured ribs in 26 places and with their lungs punctured?
Right.
That is the question. And fortunately, I actually heard Chief Sizer say something about that the other day on TV. They were asking her about, I guess, some posters have gone up, which have been slamming very nice animals, which are pigs, and but they compared police officers to those nice animals. And they were actually talking about doing something which is normally a loving act, and talking about these animals in that way.
Really?
Instead of...
Pig lovers.
Yeah, something like that.
Got it.
But in any case, these posters went up, and Chief Sizer, reading in the media, I guess, and looking at these posters, made an allegation in the Oregonian that there had been death threats against the officers. And I was watching Channel 2 News. They interviewed her and said, so what were the death threats? And she said, well, this is the kind of thing that these posters and postings on the internet lead to. And they said, so there haven't been any death threats? And she said, well, no, I haven't seen any. So basically, our police chief made something up to further inflame the situation.
Yeah.
Which
yeah,
I think
so
is very disappointing. But during that interview, too, she said this kind of poster, she said, distracts us from the issues that are on the table, such as use of force and how the police interact with people who have mental illness. And I almost fell out of my chair. I heard her admit that use of force was one of the issues on the table.
That's encouraging.
Well, perhaps there's a ray of hope. You never know.
Let's go ahead and talk to one of our listeners. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hello, caller.
Hi, good morning. Well, maybe this is the time I get to remind people to please turn your radios down.
So sorry. Are you there?
Yes. Yes, indeed.
I'm so sorry that he has to come again and again, and I'm so sorry that his work is far from finished. But I want to tell you, Dan, and this is a frightening, humming reality, I think, but be ready. Be very ready for Lindy England and her ilk, who abused so many at Abu Ghraib prison. Be prepared as these monsters from this monster-making machinery in the Middle East that we've created are coming back to fill our police forces. Mm. And it troubles me deeply that, Dan, you and I and all of us together, listener members of KABU and others, we're all going to be working for the rest of our lives on this issue. And I'm frightened by that. I hope I can see you there, girls, tonight at the Jim Chassie Memorial.
All right.
That's just my comment, because I think we're headed into time when Dan is going to have to go into overtime. And thank you, Dan, for your work.
Going to have to go into overtime.
We're going to clone you. Haven't been busy enough.
Yeah, no, well, you know, the thing is with the war in Iraq.
Thank you for your comments.
Yes, thank you very much. And with the police doing what they do, it's always overtime. But there's a lot of people out in the community doing work around all these issues, and I think it's really important for the KABU community to be part of it. And I know you're in the middle of your pledge drive, and I hope that people realize that one of the only ways we get the word out about this, the way we have big mobilizations around either police violence or military violence, is because KABU's here. So,
all right. Well, let's go ahead and take another call.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Am I on?
Yes.
Yes, you are.
Hi. I have a question for, is it Daniel, Dan?
Dan, yes.
Yeah, I can't hear you. Can you want to speak up?
Oh, his name's Dan. Did you have a question?
Dan the man. Yeah, Dan, have you ever been a police officer?
No, I haven't, but I recognize that being a police officer is a difficult job, but I also recognize that we ask them to do a job that nobody wants to see how it's being done.
And have to confront some of these mental cases, people on drugs who are basically uncontrollable.
Right. Whether or not I've been an officer, what I'm saying is, no matter how difficult it is to deal with a person, that doesn't give you the right to beat somebody down and crack all their ribs or shoot them.
I have a good friend who's a police officer, and when these guys are strung out on drugs like they are, the officer's number one objective is to protect their own lives.
Is that what it says on the side of their car? Does it say protect themselves and serve themselves, or does it say protect and serve, meaning the public? So the number one thing for them should be to make sure that everybody on the scene goes home safe.
And with that outburst, we're going to have to go ahead and let that caller go.
Well, that was very interesting. Well, I got to say something, too, though. That what I'm starting to say is that, you know, they say that if you don't like sausage, you shouldn't see it being made.
That's for
sure. So I think in our society, if you don't want to know how police officers are, quote unquote, keeping your streets safe, then don't read the People's Police Report. I'm sorry, but this is what's happening in your name. And if this is what you expected the police to do, if you're like that guy and say, who, you know, people deserve whatever they get, well, then I think you need to have a rethink, because when it's your kid or it's you or it's your aunt or uncle or your cousin or whatever, then you're going to say, wow, I didn't know that's what police did.
Right. I thought police could help.
Yeah, I think that the police are, people expect their police to, as you said, protect and serve, like it says on the side of the car. And everybody should receive the same protection and service.
I got to put it out there. I just got to say, you know, the fellow people in my community are not my enemies. I don't want to encourage or cultivate an attitude that everyone out there is potentially dangerous, that anyone at any moment, this is all crazy, we're all nuts, and we probably should all just be killed preventatively. You know, that's just, that's kind of not conducive to a good, healthy society.
Not only is it not conducive to a good, healthy society, but it really serves the Bush crime family and their cohorts, the powers that be, for us to turn against one another and be paranoid and see one another as potential threats instead of potential allies. It's serving our enemy.
Gotta say. And again, tonight, there is a memorial for James Chassie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I knew him as Jim Jim. Many of us have known him. Throughout the years, he was very involved in the very beginnings of the zine movement in the early 80s, late 70s. He's an artist. He's a person. And his memorial is tonight, as he was killed by the police in September. So tonight, Dan, could you give the time and the place?
7 o'clock, First Congregational Church, 1126 Southwest Park. And the messages that are going to be conveyed by some 20 different people, family, friends, and community organizer types, are justice, love, and remembering James Chassie Jr. And it's, again, we're, you know, it's going to be hopefully a positive and uplifting experience, as well as something that will be stirring in many ways, because there'll be a lot of emotional,
right,
emotional testimonies from his friends and family.
All right, let's go ahead and take another call. Good morning, you're on the air.
Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, that's
yes,
you.
You're
good
on
morning.
The
good morning. Hey, it's Alma.
Oh, hi,
good
Alma.
Good morning, Alma.
Hey, hello, and wonderful Dan. Hello to you.
Hi, Alma.
I just want to let people know, maybe they don't know, that they can go on this police ride around.
The ride along, yeah.
Well,
that's a very interesting experience. I did it many years ago.
Yeah, well, I think maybe more people could, you know, do it. I did it because I wanted to know my enemies, the way I put it, because they knew I was a member of Cop Watch when I went on the ride.
Good for you.
Well, yeah, they said, well, what can we do to change your attitude? I said, well, I don't know. So I said, come on and ride along with some of our officers. So I did, and the first officer was a young woman who let me know she had a couple of young children, and she would do anything to make sure she got home to her children at night. Now, to me, that doesn't sound very good, because what does anything mean?
Right. The ends justify the means is what that means.
I think that officers should do everything possible to keep themselves and everybody else alive, as was pointed out earlier. You know,
yeah, well,
it's a win-win situation.
I guess you could have taken that remark several ways, but all I can say is when I got finished riding along with the police officers, it hadn't changed my mind at all. We all agreed, yes, they were very bad officers. I did get to ride along with another woman who had the special training.
Uh-huh.
And she seemed, you know, she seemed very nice and all. But she said, I said, you know, brought up, why doesn't everybody get the training? And she said, well, you know, not everybody would be acceptable for it. Just like everybody can't get into an MBA program or wouldn't be right for it. She said,
oh,
a lot of the officers are psychologically, catch this, not prepared to take that kind of training.
Then what are they doing on the police force?
Well, I just thought I'd give you
yeah.
that information, and I don't want to take up any more of your time. Thank you for
thank
the
you
good
so
work
much for
on
that
this.
Call.
Yeah, okay.
Well, you know, going back to cite, thanks again, Alma, the Mercury article yesterday about the crisis intervention team training, they talked to a guy who helped create that in Memphis, Tennessee, and he said he compared it to the SWAT team, which we call the CERT team in Portland, that not every officer would be good for that. But I think that's a shallow analogy, and I think the point is there may be officers who, even once they get trained, won't be able to talk people down
yes. right.
effectively, but they should still have the training.
Yes, of course,
right.
some people are
training
better at it than others.
Happens, you know. I mean, that's how you try to implement change. That's how you try to institutionalize a higher level of competency
right.
within your force. Right.
And as Melody was saying before, if one officer is using this technique and another one doesn't recognize what it is because they haven't been trained that
mm-hmm.
way, that second officer might start resorting to violence when the other person is trying to do something else, and they need to be able to coordinate. One of the questions I have about the chassis cage, which I still haven't figured out, I haven't had a chance to read all the transcripts yet, is why was a Multnomah County Sheriff's deputy patrolling Northwest Portland with a Portland police officer?
Right. That's a good question.
Yeah. I mean,
that's
because they patrol
commonly.
Right. They only really do patrols in unincorporated areas of Multnomah County where they don't have their own police departments.
Was it some sort of special task force or
don't
something?
Don't know yet. But so, Mayor Potter, of course, referred to how that, you know, we're trying to clean up downtown and Old Town.
So. Oh, right. Yes. I bet it was.
Well, let's go ahead and talk to Teresa and Marlene. Good morning.
Good morning.
And let's find out how close KBOO is to finishing our fall membership drive.
Oh, we are definitely roaring towards a conclusion here. If you want your, if you want to get in and you want to get your pledge gift, it's time to call 503-232-8818 because we just raised $415, which is pretty darn good for the first break during the, during the morning rush hour. Larry Sheridan renewed.
Who are those people clapping?
Larry and Sheridan.
In Sheridan, right.
Well, it's the crowd out here. Kathleen from Gresham, Andrea from Beaverton, David, Mark, and Aaron from Portland, they've all joined up or renewed, and they have, let's see, well, one of them got the Wee Moon, so no more Wee Moon.
No more
You blew
Wee
it.
Moon.
It's a, but you can still get a tarot reading for money.
That's right. The tarot did go fast, as did Wee Moon.
Yeah. 1-877-500-KBOO for those of you listening in Salem, Corvallis, Eugene, Vancouver, and Camas. We sure would like to get a call from you right now. 1-877-500-5266. It could be done in minutes, and you would lose your chance to get Parallel Worlds by Michio Kaku. That's, you can get that just for $60. You know, you can make deals with us, and I like to ask people to pledge $10 a month. If you did that,
that's
you could get
idea.
A couple of books. Like, you could get Parallel Worlds, which is awesome. And indicates that the universe is weirder than fiction, just from pure scientific examination. You could get that and Earth Democracy by Vandana Shiva, for example, if you pledge $10 a month. You could also get Censored 2007. I mean, not all three, but you could get Censored 2007 by Project Censored and Peter Phillips, which brings together many of the issues that Ani and Melody are constantly bringing up. Hey, Dan, have you seen the newspaper this morning?
No, I didn't get a chance to. What's in there?
Well, you probably know from Travis Ava, who recently saved me from a couple of years in jail.
Yes.
That there was a suit against one of the officers that beat the hell out of...
Yeah, Officer Humphreys.
Yeah, and it was $30,000, and it's on the front page of the Oregonian that they had to pay out. And it says the suit alleged that Humphreys struck the man about, 30 times with his baton. This is someone who was the wrong person.
Oh, lovely.
Hitting him across the shins and midsection, and that the officers then, quote, maliciously lied, end quote, in their police reports to justify taking the teenager into custody when they realized he wasn't the man they were after. And, you know, I always say, I know there's so many great cops out there, and I work with them, but I've seen a cop get right up on the witness stand and lie his butt off against me just because he hated my guts.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that's the important thing about KBOO is that like Portland Cop Watch, you acknowledge that there, you know, it's not... like every single cop is bad. It's that there are systemic problems that we need to change. And one of the reasons that we've been able to do our work on a measly budget, like Peace and Justice Works annual budget is about $10,000 to $12,000 a year. But that's subsidized by KBOO because when we have an event or we're trying to get the word out about police stuff like that.
But don't you get paid a salary for working there?
No.
Oh, you don't need KBOO. You've been listening
there?
To 30-minute discussions of this on KTU, right? On
yeah, KXL. Sure. Half-hour discussions or 90-minute talk shows like this.
Hey, folks, I'm going to break in here because the listeners need to know the number to
that's
call.
That's right.
503-232-8818 or 1-877-500-KBOO. We'll get back to talk radio in a moment, and Teresa and Dan can continue on. But we got to let listeners know how to call to support this kind of thing, folks. We have about $1,800 to go to completely finish this membership drive.
Let's do it.
And I think $1,800 is doable, but we need to hear the phones ring. So we're going to help you do that with 503-232-8818. And we've got some good news for you. We have found that we actually have two more copies of the Wee Moon calendar, the date book. So there are two more copies for a $75 minimum pledge. We still have on the table the Tarot readings by Ani for a $100 minimum pledge. We still have the a pair of tickets for the Jammin' for Peace concert tomorrow night for a $60 minimum pledge.
So you know what to do.
There you go. We've got a gift certificate to Mississippi Pizza for a $100 minimum pledge.
Pizza.
So, you know, we got a whole range of things. Of course, we have all kinds of political books, political intrigue, as well as political information. But
call
the number
now.
Is 503-232-8818 or www.kboo.fm. Let me say that one more time because someone called and said we don't give the number out often enough. 503-232-8818.
And let me just tell you what's coming up this morning on KBOO. Why some even more great stuff coming up. Why you should pledge. At 9 on the Friday Radio Zine, we're going to hear Martha Odom speaking with anarcho-primitivist. That's a nice term. Writer Derek Jensen. His latest book is a two-volume set called Endgame. That's why you should call 503-232-8818. At 10, Aaron Yankee will interview Jason Renault of the Mental Health Association and Tom Antron of the local Mental Health Advisory Board about the James Chassie killing. At 10:30, it's Boneheads and Bigots with Pat McGuire, 232-8818. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, a correspondent for Rolling Stone magazine talks about his article, The Worst Congress Ever. That's why you should call 503-232-8818 now and show your support.
And
you
know, yay, people are calling.
There we go. And, you know, I'd just like to know how many other radio stations are making it a prominent piece of information regarding the James Chassie memorial tonight. I think a lot of them will cover it as some kind of news event because it is in the news. But how many are letting people know how to go if they want to go? How many are helping people understand the whole context, not only why this is important for the individual human being, James Chassie, who lost his life in such a miserable way, but for what it means for our community in such a big political way? How many stations are doing that? So if you support this, you need to help us out by becoming a member at 503-232-8818. Oh, here's another thing for a $60 minimum pledge, a couple of tickets for the Boo Ball, which is coming up on Tuesday.
Boo Ball. Going to
that's the Boo Bash, ball, I believe.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
The Boo Bash.
Well, no.
It says ball on our
back
little,
here. Back here, the advertisements
we'll
say ball,
it.
Bash. I don't know. Anyway. Oh, the postcard says
ball
bash.
Ball bash, that's the lesbian
well, the poster
event.
Says ball. Anyway, the party. Okay.
Anyway. I made you laugh.
Yeah, there you go. Join the party at 503-232-8818.
503-232-8818, and I'm glad to see that we are busily taking calls. My gosh, as a matter of fact, you can't even get through this very second. You're going to have to wait a minute. But while you're waiting, consider what delicious premiums you would like to have. And I would also like to encourage you to consider that $10 a month pledge, because we are roaring up to the finish here, and we get some of those $10 a month pledges in here and give out some of our tasty thank you gifts. And heck, we're going to be done with the substantial fall 06 membership drive, which I have much enjoyed, and which I've been fattened by, actually. Who are we thanking for
You've
our restaurant this morning? Is it
Beaterville
Cafe this morning?
We're thanking Beaterville Cafe over on Killingsworth.
2201 North Killingsworth.
I love food. It's one of my favorite things. So if you're still debating as to whether or not you should call now, 503-232-8818, let me tell you what you could get. For a $75 pledge, you could get A Power Governments Cannot Suppress by Howard Zinn. Awesome. The Great Turning by David Corton. Equally awesome. For a $60 minimum pledge, you could get Igniting a Revolution, Voices in Defense of the Earth. That's edited by Stephen Best. Or, of course, is the aforementioned Project Censored, 2007, for a $75 pledge. Global Class War by Jeff Foe for $60. I mean, there's some just great stuff out there. 503-232-8818.
And, there you have it. Call KBOO. Support us, won't you? Please help us finish this.
Help us finish this, huh? Finish
us off. Finish this.
Well, when people involuntarily pay their taxes, a lot of them are going to end up going into families' and lawyers' pockets because of all the lawsuits that are getting filed against the police. But if you give your money to KBOO, maybe you will end up actually having that money go to community services like you'd like it to.
I love that. That was an excellent way of reframing it, Dan.
Actually, most of our taxes are going to Iraq, probably.
We have
the local
tax base. Well, we have a caller with a question or a comment that I would love to squeeze on in now. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Oh, great. Hey, I'm a long-term a longtime KBOO supporter, and I just want to call for the highest level of civility possible when referring to the police officers and using terms like pigs. You lower
yeah,
the debate.
Not,
that's
and,
exactly
and
what
it's
I
a
was
failure.
Saying.
Let me finish, please. Okay. It's a failure to recognize there are progressive forces within the department that are trying to fight this fight inside, and you don't serve to improve the force and improve it by engaging in that kind of talk.
I want to be clear that we weren't doing that. What I was saying is that pigs are actually very nice animals, and when you use a derogatory term, use it, that name as a derogatory term, it's actually, it doesn't make any sense. I don't know.
Toward the animals. And again, it's just an ignorant misunderstanding of the role that the police plays and the challenge that progressive forces within the department have to improve their behavior and the way they are.
I don't disagree with you, Carl. Most of our newsletters are up online on our website, www.portlandcopwatch.org, and we never refer to police officers with names like that. We don't use those kinds of derogatory terms in our
You did it on the air this morning.
No, he was referring to posters that
somebody else put up.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't put those posters up. I'm sorry you misunderstood, but I was not.
And I think it's important to be clear about that. That was not, we have not called officers pigs this morning. I think that when you look at the broader scope of what, Portland Cop Watch and, the Portland Peace and Justice Works Group does, it's about conflict resolution.
Right.
It's about bringing, peace to communities. And obviously when you engage in mudslinging and, blatant disrespect, that doesn't encourage those ends.
Right. No, actually, Cop Watch is on the same page as you are.
I'm sorry that was perhaps misunderstood.
Yeah. Well, that's how it came across. So
All right. Well, thanks very much for your call.
I issue an apology anybody that misunderstood.
If you haven't seen the People's Police Report, it's really an excellent newsletter. Where could they get that, Dan, if people wanted to see that newsletter you're holding?
Well, right now we don't actually have it out in any distribution sites around town, so they should write or call us, and we can send them a copy. Our email address is copwatch@portlandcopwatch.org, and our phone number is 503-236-3065.
And I know that people that are supporting members of Cop Watch actually get these.
It's really an excellent publication. That. Very well done and very filled with information and thought-provoking and not at all demonizing the officers involved.
And we have done this for almost, I guess this is 14 years we've been publishing this newsletter. And so it's, when somebody calls up and asks me, has anybody ever been fired for shooting somebody? I just kind of pick up the back issues and flip through it and kind of try to remember. But the only person that I can remember, we were talking about this before, the only person I can remember was this guy, Douglas Erickson, who shot Gerald Grattan in the back 3 times.
Right.
Now, let's just looking at this past year in Portland, it's kind of – people kind of lose track of this stuff. But there have been 3 shooting incidents, and there have been 2 deaths in custody now. So this is kind of shaping up to be kind of more than average year, I guess, in Portland police history. The first shooting was this lieutenant whose sister called him because somebody was sitting outside of her house in a car, and the lieutenant didn't tell anybody where he was going, went off his precinct into a separate area of with somebody else's beat, really, to check out this thing in his personal life, his sister, his sister's house, perhaps under threat, and woke up the guy, and the guy, he ended up shooting and killing this guy. And then in March, Tim Grant was running in and out of traffic, much like Jim Chassis allegedly was doing, and officers came up and tasered him multiple times, and he died in police custody. And that was our first, as far as we know, first taser-related death of a human here in Portland. There have been a dog that had died after being tasered before. Then in July, there was a gentleman who went to the recruiting station with a gun, and police ended up shooting and killing him. And then I think it was in August, this actually was after we went to print, I guess, where there was a guy who was engaged in a car chase, and the police hit the back bumper of his car, flipped it over, it caught on fire, and they got out and had a foot chase, at the end of which they shot him That guy lived, which is a very rare occurrence in Portland, but we haven't heard any follow-up on that case, or really anybody talking about that in the broader context of what's going on with Jim Chassis' case.
Right.
And then we had the Jim Chassis case. And, of course, also people who pay attention to the news have seen that in the past month or so, there have been like 5 or 6 shootings in outlying areas.
Right, Forest
yes.
Grove.
Forest Grove, Vancouver, Tigard, and it's just... an epidemic.
One problem that I feel compelled to point out is that one of the common threads we're seeing here is that we no longer have mental health facilities to speak of in this area, and the police often are dealing with people who really should be receiving mental health services and are not. And this is part of the problem, is that these people are not getting the help they need, and therefore the police end up confronting them. And it's not just the police. Yeah, there's a lot more to this equation than just the police being out of control. It's a complicated situation.
Certainly if the police had higher levels of skill in this area and weren't out of control.
Yes, that would help, but the mental health services would help, too.
I would agree. We do have a phone caller. Let's go ahead and take your question or comment now. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hello, caller.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Hi. Hey, I just wanted to bring up something that maybe a lot of people forgot about in Portland.
All right.
That this isn't the first time the police have had somebody die in their custody or in their care.
No, absolutely.
I want to call it that. Do you remember a gentleman who was killed... in the same kind of a manner on Lombard near Interstate.
That was Dickie
Dow. About 8 years ago. Well,
yeah.
I don't recall his name, but
his name was Dickie
Dow. Uh-huh. And I just think that it's important that Tom Potter instigate a training program for every last police officer, whether they're the right ones or not, for this kind of intervention. Yep. So that they can recognize what's going on.
Well, you should call the mayor's office and tell them that.
Yeah, since we have a mayor who used to be a police chief, I think this is a unique opportunity.
Yeah, when he was put into office, but I'm really concerned that there's been several, what look like in my mind, questionable killings by the police.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not a cop, so I don't know what it's like to be one, but I know what it's like to be afraid of them.
Right. I know what it's like to be a citizen in my community.
Yes.
Right. Actually, that brings up another problem with the police training, which is that they're trained to fear the community.
Right.
That when the Jahar Perez case, which was a guy who was in North Portland driving around in a car that the police thought was too fancy for the neighborhood, and they thought he was reaching for a gun in his pocket, but it was probably a cell phone, he ended up getting shot and killed. And... during that inquest, they showed a training tape where the officer involved, Officer Siri, kind of failed to pull his gun out appropriately because there's a guy slumped over in a car. And in the scenario, the guy slumped over in the car was faking it and had a gun under the seat. So basically, their training scenarios are set up to make you fear every traffic stop and fear everybody you come up on. And I think that's actually tied, I think, to the whole racial profiling question, where they're not coming up to the window and saying, "My name is Officer So and So." Again, Chief Sizer pledges that they're trying to make that the norm, so that when there is a traffic stop, that's what the officers will do. They'll come over and introduce themselves and try to let you know why they pulled you over if it's appropriate for the situation. I'm sure there's going to be some situations where driving erratically, or if they are pointing a gun at the cop, they're not going to say hi, what my name is. But and
but
we
to have that be normative,
exactly. So that's a good pledge. We want to see it, follow through on it. But it would be it's one thing that can help.
I want to squeeze in one last caller here for a question or comment.
Good morning. That last call was actually a perfect segue, because I want to point out that Tom Potter kind of cultivated in his campaign for the office of mayor this kind of Andy and Mayberry kind of former policeman type of issue, and really the only specific campaign promises that I really remember outside of kind of these big visioning statements was that he was going to clean up the police force. The Kendred James incident was very, very high profile at the time, and I think that's partly responsible for how he carried the progressive vote in Portland.
Right.
And to date, these were all campaign promises, as I recall, that there was going to be this training.
We need to remind him of that.
Change the culture of the police force. Mm-hmm. And yet he hasn't done anything.
Right.
And I think that in the context of this conversation and recent events, I think it's more than fair to bash on Tom Potter.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your call.
Yeah. Well, let me say this. Another thing that the City Hall needs to be reminded about is that we do have a police review board in the city, though very few people would even think that that's true. And according to the auditor, they have no oversight into police shootings, but that's not really true. But anyway, not to belabor the point, there's supposed to be a review of that review board structure, the Independent Police Review Division, and the money was sitting in Sam Adams' office for a year. Nothing got done. It's $60,000 to do a review of the review board, and now it's in Mayor Potter's office. And because the public has not been having a sharp outcry about why isn't our police review board able to do things about this kind of thing, they're just sitting on it.
Right.
So I think they need to hear more from people about that. Can I also just say that the Jahar Perez case I was referencing before, the family did file a lawsuit, and they're going to trial in November, Monday, November 13th. It will be starting at the Pioneer Courthouse downtown. That's the courthouse after which Pioneer Courthouse Square is named. So it's right on the south or the east side of Pioneer Square, right on the east side of Pioneer Square.
Right.
Starting 9 a.m. on November 13th. So people who have followed that case, if you can take some time off of work during that week and pop in for a few hours, remember not to wear metal things or bring anything that could be misconstrued as a weapon. I'm going to be careful with my words now this morning.
Yeah, right.
Sorry about what happened before with that thing. But nothing that could be misconstrued as a weapon. And then you can go in the Pioneer Courthouse and observe this trial starting on the 13th.
All right, Dan Handelman, thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you for
morning.
All you do.
And we have Marlene, we have Teresa, and
how's
we have a
going?
Progress report.
All right. Well, we have Margaret, Alma, Nancy, Maggie, Randall, and Dennis.
Woo!
All from Portland, except Randall, who's from Tualatin, calling to become members or renew this morning. Margaret,
yay.
Alma, Nancy, Maggie, Randall, Dennis, thank you very, very much. We have made the matching pledge.
Woo-hoo!
And so... And we still have a little ways to go.
We're in the home stretch. We're almost there. We can see the finish line and the crowd cheering. Let's go, go, go. 503-232-8818.
And a couple more folks to thank. We have Diane from Portland and Bill from Wilsonville, both of whom have become members this morning or renewed. And so we definitely want to say thank you.
That means with the matching grant, we're getting down to less than 1,000. I think, or pretty close to that, to wrap up the whole pledge drive, the whole membership drive.
503-232-8818. 503-232-8818.
Yes, and unlike what you're hearing in the background here, hey folks, keep it down. We're on the air here.
Too much partying.
The folks answering the phones are so excited they're starting to rattle off 1-800 have your tarot read. No, that's not the number. That is not the number.
1-800 witch. No.
Yeah. The number is 503-232-8818. If you want to say that I took KBOO home to the home stretch, I helped them
let's make that goal.
Let's get it done. And get on to, 24/7 programming rather than these frequent breaks asking you to help us out.
Well, we love to provide the heightened attention on the fact that we are listener-supported, member-owned and operated radio. That's a rare thing, and it's good to give folks the opportunity to actively participate in that, which we do every 6 months with these membership drives on the air. 503-232-8818.
This is
the
your
number
very
you
last
can call
chance.
To join in and support Positively Revolting Talk Radio, support Speaking Truth to Power, and, again, if you want a tarot reading, I have to say, I walked into the back room this morning, and there are two women who are now volunteers at KBOO who I met originally by giving them tarot readings because they pledged to our show years ago. And it's kind of cool.
Be
I walk back
forewarned,
there and I'm like, wow,
those of
go
you who
figure.
Asked for that tarot
yes.
reading.
Feel
be
the
forewarned.
Tractor beam sucking you into KBOO, which is always your answer.
And the number...
503-232-8818.
There you go. Or www.kboofm.fm.
I know that,
join now.
Excellent. I know that folks that listen to Positively Revolting are also news and public affairs junkies like myself. And we do
plug
have some
IV.
Books that are available for your minimum pledge. There are some books left, even at this date.
Okay, let me rattle off just a few.
I got it.
Oh,
you
got it?
Talk
okay.
about one or two.
All right, go ahead.
That I'm personally excited about. Igniting a Revolution, Voices in Defense of the Earth. This is edited by Stephen Best, and it includes essays by Derek Jensen, one of my favorites, who we'll be hearing from in just coming up next. Actually, he'll be interviewed by Martha Odom. It includes other voices from the deep ecology movement and the radical environmentalist movement. So that is a $60 minimum pledge, Igniting a Revolution, Voices in Defense of the Earth, Project Censored, 2007. $75 minimum pledge, if you were listening to KBOO, say 3 weeks ago, maybe it was four now, who's counting? Project Censored editor Dr. Andy Roth was interviewed by my very own Teresa Mitchell, and that was an excellent interview and a great book. $75 minimum pledge would get you that and your membership to KBOO. Join now, call now, call
503-232-8818.
And for those of you in Corvallis, Salem, Vancouver, Camas, all over the place, 1-877-552-66. I'll say it slower. 1-877 is the toll-free number. And then you just dial 500, and then KBOO, which comes out to 5266, 1-877-500-KBOO.
How many lines do we have open, Teresa?
How many lines do we have open?
Maybe one at the moment.
One line open.
503-232-8818.
And let me just remind you again, we do have, for $60 minimum pledge, one pair of tickets to the Jammin' for Peace concert tomorrow night. Still one pair of tickets. It's going to be musicians from Iran, Iraq, Turkey, as well as a number of Jewish musicians coming together to show that people can create beautiful music even when governments create war.
The Ney and the Oud together.
Absolutely. There you go.
503-232-8818.
Well, not to mention the Boo Bash bursting out of the grave and coming back into reality.
Bursting out of the grave. Oh,
so
dear.
Look at this. You know, if you are one who enjoys
zombies,
the celebratory aspects of being involved with KBOO, for $120, you could get the Jammin' for Peace tickets as well as the Boo Bash tickets and just make it a weekend of music
take
and celebration.
Out all week.
1-877-500-KBOO.
And you know what? I renewed my membership just 3 weeks ago, and
yay!
I feel so much better because of it.
I bet
yay,
you do.
Dan,
I
it
do.
Really works.
It does.
I bet you do. You look 10 years younger, Dan.
Thank you.
I appreciate you taking your time to come on to KBOO and to give us the information you do and for doing the work you do, which is very, very hard work. Looking at things that are pretty horrifying, whether it be across the seas or in our own backyard. Mm-hmm. I really do thank you for doing what you do and continuing that work and allowing other people opportunities to participate in a broad-based struggle.
Yay, Dan.
And 503-232-8818.
It can still happen. You can still get that KBOO t-shirt before the end of the pledge drive, which might happen in seconds.
It could.
And we do have that gift certificate to Mississippi Pizza for $100 minimum pledge. That's less than $10 a month. We also have a six-pack of Hot Lips Pizza House Soda for a $60 minimum pledge. So we've got all kinds of ways to say thank you.
I love the House Soda.
503-232-8818. See?
I like the helpful prompting.
There you go.
That's the peanut gallery democracy.
There we go. That's one of those folks that hasn't gotten to answer the phone in a couple of minutes. They're getting lonely and sad and cold, and so they want us to say this number, 503-232-8818. They need to talk to somebody. They need to hear the power of the human voice. They need to hear you at 503-232-8818 or 1-877-500-KBOO.
People-powered radio. It happens when you make it so. 503-232-8818 or 1-877-500-5266. Do consider giving that 1 hour a month wage for KBOO. It's really all right. A lot of people actually have taken us up on that suggestion. I've taken interesting calls for great amounts, like $8.64.
Awesome.
You know, it's like, oh, and I always ask, how'd you come up with that? They're like, well, that's what I make. It's like,
I love
okay,
it.
All right, there you go.
Well, you know, and by people power, we don't mean we have a giant hamster wheel on the roof with people running around in it.
No.
Although we might have to resort
are
to that.
Are you sure?
You don't call
are you
now.
Sure? When have you, when was the last time you looked?
503-232-8818.
Good point, Marlene. 503-232-8818. 1-877-500-5266. I really do want to thank very deeply all the people that have called and supported this wonderful community resource over the last 3 weeks. We thank you very much. And if you haven't taken it upon yourself to do that yet, here's your last chance. We do certainly hope. In the next couple hours, we will reach that goal. It could happen almost immediately if you make it so. 503-232-8818.
All right, and the time is 9:05. And coming up this morning on KBOO, on the Friday radio zine, Martha Odom speaks with anarcho-primitivist writer Derek Jensen. His latest book is a two-volume set called Endgame. At 10, Aaron Yankee interviews Jason Renaud of the Mental Health Association and Tom Antron of the Local Mental Health Advisory Board about the James Chassie killing. At 10:30, it's Boneheads and Bigots with Pat McGuire. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, a correspondent for Rolling Stone magazine talks about his article, The Worst Congress Ever. Stay tuned for the Friday radio zine.
Dang, man, this is a long week. So what you doing this weekend?
Oh, man, I don't know. I'm just going to hang out with my girl, you know, chill.
Nah, man, don't hang out with the girl. I'm going to take you somewhere.
Well, where are you going to take me?
Hold up. I'll tell you right now.
All right.
Deck out in your funkiest Halloween costume for the KBOO Boo Bash. This fundraiser will be broadcast live and features a wide range of Portland's best underground musical talent, including Fleshstone, D&D, Evolutionary Jazz Band, DJ P-Disco, and much more. The party takes place at Holocene, located at 1001 Southeast Morrison, on Halloween night, Tuesday, October 31st, from 8 p.m. to 2 a.m. For more information, please check out KBOO on the web at kboo.fm.
Dr. Nine! Dr. Nine! I'm back!
Have you secured the media outlet for the 900 Club's inaugural broadcast, Schlichtenstein?
Yes, Doctor. Monday, October 30th at 11 p.m. on KBOO during a radio theater show called The Southern Radio Project.
You diminutive timid!
Ow!
Radio theater? Community radio? Monday night at 11? You might as well be entering the Barry Manilow Marathon.
But, Doctor, if your nine wave can penetrate the cultured, independent minds of the KBOO radio theater audience, listeners to enter PRCOM channel stations will be easy pickings.
You're right, Schlichtenstein. This is merely phase one of Plan 9 from Uber Space. The sudden radio broadcast on Monday, October 30th at 11 p.m. will make the Exorcist look like Pippi Longstockings. A Halloween horror show written, produced, and directed by...
Music from Iran, Iraq, and Turkey will be performed live at Jammin' for Peace on Saturday, October 28th. Musicians from Iran and Iraq will be joined by Jewish-American musicians, all emphasizing that peace among peoples endures regardless of their government's warring interests. Musicians featured include Iraqi musician and composer Rahim Alhaj, Iranian reed flute performer Hossein Omumi, and Yani Ses, a Seattle-based group of Turkish-American musicians. Jammin' for Peace is happening on Saturday, October 28th, with music from Iran, Iraq, Turkey, and beyond. This all can be found at the First Congressional Church, located at 1126 Southwest Park Avenue in downtown Portland. Tickets are $15 for general admission and $10 for students. KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of this event for peace.
This is KBOO Portland. First up on the program today on the Friday radio zine, Martha Odom speaks with Derek Jensen, author of numerous books, most recently Endgame, which challenges the values and tactics of some of history's most influential pacifists, as well as the sustainability movement and the environmental movement. Derek Jensen will be speaking tonight at Disjecta Gallery at 2:30 East Burnside at 7 p.m. There is a charge for this event.
Good morning. This is Martha Odom, KBOO Radio. With us today, back in Portland, is Derek Jensen, who is the author of A Language Older Than Words, The Culture of Make-Believe, and the newly published from Seven Stories Press, Endgame. So before we talk politics, tell us a little bit about yourself. Who is Derek Jensen?
I kind of hate that question because I don't know how to answer.
Let us know who the person is a little bit.
Well, see, that's the thing is, am I a writer? Because all the answers end up being so precious. You know, I'm a human being who lives Talawa land in Northern California. And that's true, but it also sounds kind of precious. I mean, but I hate to say I'm a writer because I'm not just a writer. I'm also an activist. I'm also a human being. Anyway, so a little bit. I live in Northern California. I like that because I'm not saying I am.
Mm-hmm.
I live in Northern California. I live on Talawa land. And I've pretty much devote my life to both understanding this culture's pervasive destructiveness and to, more importantly, to stopping it. And I guess I'm comfortable with that, with saying that's who I am, is I'm somebody who desperately wants to stop this culture from killing the planet.
I'd love to spend one whole interview talking about your experiences teaching creative writing at Pelican Bay Prison. That I've been around that place a little bit, and it's pretty interesting stuff, but we'll save that for another time.
That'd be great.
Endgame. It's probably the most aerobic book I've ever read. I've got lots of exercise walking around trying to digest all the information in it. One of the major premises is civilization is bad. All our conditioning, like from day one, teaches that civilization is right. Everything from our national identity down to how we deal with bodily functions. So what's the deal? What's the problem with civilization?
Well, there's a bunch of them, not the least of which is that it's killing the planet. And it's really extraordinary to believe that you can destroy a planet and live on it, too. And this, you know, I mentioned before that I live on Talawa land, and the Talawa lived here for 12,500 years, if you believe what science tells us, and if you believe what the Talawa tell us, then they lived here since the beginning of time. And this culture has been here for 170 years, and it's hammering the area. And, you know, whatever measure we want to take, you know, the passenger pigeons are gone, the salmon are going, there's 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone, there's, you know, the oceans are essentially murdered, global warming, you know, there's dioxin in every mother's breast milk, you know, whatever. The USGS, not, you know, flaming environmentalists, but the USGS says that there's carcinogens in every stream in the United States, and which shouldn't surprise us once again, since there's carcinogens in every mother's breast milk. And it's absolutely insane to think that you can destroy a planet and live on it. So there's, on that level, it's bad. On another level, it destroys every indigenous culture it encounters. I mean, try living as a hunter-gatherer in a functioning community on Manhattan Island at this point. You know, it systematically destroys alternatives. It systematically destroys indigenous peoples. There have been cultures that have existed with either no or very low rape. There have existed cultures where child abuse is pretty much non-existent. You know, it's like, what measure do you want to choose? And we can talk about that. But of course we have to perceive ourselves as the best way to be, because for a couple reasons. One is that no one can commit any mass atrocity without first convincing themselves and others that what they're doing is not in fact harmful, but instead good. I mean, from his own perspective, Hitler wasn't committing genocide, he was purifying the Aryan race. And the whites who stole the land from the Indians were not committing genocide, they were fulfilling their manifest destiny. And nowadays, you know, this is not killing the planet, it's developing natural resources. And I mean, this is true on a personal level too. I mean, I don't know about you, but I have never in my life been a jerk. Every time I've ever been a jerk, I've had it fully rationalized beforehand. And then afterwards, of course, I can go, oh my gosh, I was a real jerk. But for the most part, the capacity to rationalize is pretty extraordinary. And that's part of what we have to convince ourselves in order to continue with this wretched system. And it, which once again, I mean, it's not just salmon out there or, you know, passenger pigeons out there. And it's not, I mean, there's a couple things. One of them is that I ask people at my talk, how many of you have had someone you love die of cancer? And about 90% or 80% say that they have had someone they love die of cancer. And of course, cancer is a disease of civilization due in part to the toxification of the total environment.
And in many ways, reading through your book, the real big C is not cancer, which is only a symptom, but civilization that's the cause.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And it's been systematically. I mean, we say that one of the signs of intelligence is the ability to recognize patterns. And I'm going to lay out a pattern here, and let's see if we can recognize it in less than 6,000 years. When people think of the hillsides and plains of Iraq, you know, is the first thing that they think of, cedar forest so thick that sunlight never touches the ground. That's how it was prior to civilization beginning. The first written myth of this culture is Gilgamesh cutting the forest to make cities. And the Arabian Peninsula was oak forest. And the Near East, you know, there's the cedars of Lebanon, you know, they still have one on their flag. And that was all heavily forested. And Greece was heavily forested. Aristotle, I think it was complaining that deforestation was damaging water quality. And I'm sure that those in power said, yeah, we need to study this for a couple of years to make sure there's a real connection. They probably formed a committee or something. And North Africa was heavily forested. And, you know, forests precede this culture and deserts dog its heels. It's just, this culture has been destroying its land base, and it's been destroying all adjoining cultures as it metastasizes across the globe. And once again, it's not just out there. You know, it's also, I ask people if they like their jobs, and about 90% say no. And what does that mean when the vast majority of people spend the vast majority of their waking hours doing things that they'd rather not do?
You state in the book that cities are an essential piece of civilization as destruction, and you point out that for a city to exist, you have to import resources, that a city can't grow its own food, doesn't have resources for building materials, the whole gamut of stuff that you need to survive in a city, you got to get from someplace else. So where do you go for it?
Well, see, that's one of the deals, too, is I've been bashing civilization for, gosh, 10 or 15 years now. And when I did this book, I realized, you know, I've been bashing it for a long time, I probably better define it. And the way I define it is civilization is a way of life that's based on, that's characterized by the growth of cities. And that's nice, Derek, but what's a city? So a city I've defined as a collection of people living in numbers large enough to require the importation of resources. So the Talua, whom I've mentioned a few times, were not civilized. They didn't have cities. They didn't require the importation of resources. They lived with what the land gave willingly. And a couple of things happen as soon as you require the importation of resources. One of them is that your way of life can never, ever be sustainable, because as soon as you require the importation of resources, it means you've denuded the landscape of that particular resource. And as your city grows, you'll denude an ever larger area, as we see. And the other thing it means is that your way of life must be based on violence, because if you require the importation of resources, trade will never be sufficiently reliable, because if the people next watershed over aren't going to trade you for it, you'll take it. And so what this means is we could all become absolutely enlightened, and the U.S. military would still have to be huge, because how else are they going to get access to oil? How else are they going to steal oil from people all over the world, which they need to maintain their economic system? And that goes back to the whole sustainability thing, that you know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that any way of life that's based on the use of non-renewable resources won't last. Eventually, you know, you'll use it up. So if you have a way of life that's based on, oh gosh, I don't know, let's take a random example, oil, you know, eventually you're going to run out, and it would be really wise to think about what you're going to do then. And so, you know, it's not sustainable, and it destroys the land bases, and we need to face that fact, and we need to do something about it. So even if it were, even if civilization were this wonderful, amazing, beautiful thing, then we would still need to face the fact that you can't destroy a planet and live on it. And I have a new slogan these days, which is, protect your land base. You can't have sex without it. and the reason is because it doesn't matter. I love baseball, you know, except the designated hitter rule. I love baseball, and I love Beethoven and Mozart and blues. And, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that I like, but that doesn't alter the fact that you can't, if you're destroying the planet, if you're destroying your land base, nothing else matters. That's the most important thing. The only measure by which we'll be judged by the people who come after is the health of the land base.
In case there are people who come after.
Exactly.
We are talking with Derek Jensen, author of Endgame. Derek.
Okay, and we're going to take a little break right there. You can see Derek Jensen this evening at Disjecta Gallery, 230 East Burnside at 7 p.m. And we will come back to that interview with Martha Odom and Derek Jensen. But first, we are going to go and talk with Bill about why it's important for you to call right now at 503-232-8818 and join KBOO.
Thanks, Trillium. Hey, Ani, have a chair. Have a chair. Put that bag down, girlfriend. Sit down. We're going to do a little pitching here. This is the last chance.
Bill, you are so persuasive. So persuasive.
Well, how's the arm?
It'll get better.
It'll get better now. All right. Hey, people. We're near the end. We're near the end. We need you to run like heck, and let's fulfill this pledge drive. Let's get her done. Let's just get her done.
I love that. 503-232-8818.
What's that number? 503-232-8818. Make the phones ring. Come on, people, wake up in this room here.
The amazing, fierce determination of Bill.
That's right. You normally hear me on Saturday mornings, but today we're pushing so that I don't have to do this tomorrow. Make me a happy man.
This
is purely a selfish effort on my part.
503-232-8818.
We're listening to Derek Jensen.
That's right. Derek Jensen is, in fact, one of my favorite authors, and he has recently completed this two-volume set. It's a tome and a half. Okay, I take it back. It's two tomes. There you go.
Bookends.
It's a $120 minimum pledge. It could be yours. It is, in fact,
It's heavy, but compelling. The dude is right on.
It's really quite good. I have to say, the first book was stolen from my car while I was at a radio conference a month ago.
Good choice of theft.
But it was, you know, as I recall, it's a really, again, insightful and compelling look at the unsustainable nature of our civilization, of our culture, what's wrong, how we got here. The second volume,
503-232-8818, we've got lines open. Call now.
Is about the resistance. Is about actually loving life and choosing positive action, taking it down and building up a sustainable society of, well, you know, community, and sustainable values, deep ecology around us, something that is worth actually, struggling for now and seeing in our lifetimes. 503-232-8818. It's really about being part of the resistance. It's about being defiant in rather perilous times. It's about supporting the community that supports you, your very own community resource, KBOO, 503-232-8818.
Do you need to be reminded again? Come on. Room, wake up, people. Clap your hands over there. Clap your hands. Come on, KBOO.
Call us now, people. Phones. We need those that happy chiming bell sound. And, you know, if you are listening to this interview with Martha Odom.
We've got another $500 matching pledge for this break.
Oh, my goodness.
People, make us happy.
$500, that means that the first $500 in will be matched, will be counted double as support for KBOO, your very own community radio station. Right now, you are listening to an interview with Martha Odom, one of our very own homegrown KBOO volunteers.
Right.
And she's interviewing Derek Jensen, a really, really deep thinker, really amazing author. I've had the pleasure of interviewing him and speaking with him a few times now. And he is somebody who has an ability to lay bare really uncomfortable truth and to let it sort of sit there, kind of uncomfortable. And that is a rare thing. And that is, in fact, the kind of truth-telling that we need right now so that we can get about the social change work that is so important to move our culture towards sustainability. 503-232-8818. Or, hey, maybe you are not in Portland directly. Maybe you're living in Camas. Maybe you're in Washougal. Maybe you're in Sweet Home or Sublimity.
Sublimity.
I love that city.
It's sublime.
What's that number, Bill?
It's 1-877-500-5266, also known as KBOO. Portland, Oregon. Come on, call us now, people. Do we have to have a face-off between towns? You know, can I get something going between Lake Oswego and Oregon City?
Do we have
to insult banjo players or something? Can we get
works on Friday mornings.
Yeah, Saturday mornings.
Saturday mornings, yeah.
What else? How about poets and And
go for anarchists versus socialists. No, wait. No, that's not it. 503, we're all in this boat together. That's the one. 503-232-8818. 503-232-8818. We're having a good time. We're with each other in this community radio station. Why? Because we are passionate about the information, because we are passionate about community, and we are passionate about people-powered media. You are the people. You must power this station.
Absolutely.
We have been raising money and support for KBOO now for about 3 weeks and 3 days. But who's counting? We are actually thrilled to be able to offer you the opportunity to join this media resource, to make it strong, to continue our legacy now with you, you as a vital participatory part.
I've got two phone lines open.
232-8818. $120 minimum pledge gets you this two-volume set. It is really quite good. I have to say, I've read part two before I've read part one, since part one was stolen.
That works for me.
You know, but I have to say, I'm really glad I got to read the book on resistance. It was inspiring. It was awesome in that coming together kind of way that Derek Jensen has. He's one of the authors that, I don't know, I love him because he's less linear than I am, and that takes some doing. 503-232-8818.
Yeah, you're going through some pledge drive blues here. Come on, let's make it to
the
end.
That's it, come on.
Pull in your breath, suck in your breath, and run that extra mile for us here. We want to have this thing over today by Democracy Now.
Let's
make it our goal. Let's have it done by Democracy Now. We'll play Democracy Now in whole, no interruption. Please, make our life happy down here. Make all of our lives going. Just call us.
Make 503. Your community strong.
That's right. 232-8818 or 1-877-500-5266. Call now, please. We've got, there we go. There's one. We got a line open. We've got one more line open. If you pay in person, you can have breakfast. Come on down. Provided by Beaterville Cafe. Later on, we're going to have lunch from Old Wives Tale. You're welcome to come on down. Pay your pledge in person. Kick back. Enjoy it with us, and let's watch this. Watch our
final
goal get filled.
Thank you so much for your support.
Yes.
Okay, we're going back to that interview with Derek Jensen and Martha Odom.
Like one of the points you made in the book that helped me. It gave name and form to something that's been floating around my head and talked about it and agonized over it. Is how much we're in denial, and that we're actually participating in our own doom. And you talked about, you said, we're all insane, and referred to it as complex PTSD. The other part is you made very, very strong parallels between domestic violence and societal violence, and we're starting to sort of understand how we deal with domestic violence, that it's a whole syndrome and has stages and stuff. Could you talk a little bit about this? Because I am continually stunned by people who don't want to know. If they know, they don't want to be reminded, they don't want to do anything about it, well, let's just go shopping or drink beer and watch the ballgame.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's just several parts to this. One of them is, in the 1960s, this guy, Lester Laborsky, did this experiment where he attached electrodes to people's eyeballs, and he would track where they would look. And what he found, he would show them photographs, and what he found was that if the photograph contained something that they found morally objectionable or that threatened their worldview, their eyes would never once track to it, never once, which means they would see it out of the corner of their eyes, and they would know where not to look. And, you know, this happens all the time, but it's like I had this friend who said she wished she could just shake George Bush and say to him, you could do so much to stop global warming and blah, blah, blah. And I said, look, I can tell you exactly what he would say, which is, I have no idea what you're talking about. I mean, a lot of it is the denial is so deep that you literally can't see it. And we can't just, I mean, don't even need to look at George Bush. There's a great example, several years ago, this woman got arrested. She was the wife of a DEA agent in Colombia, the head DEA guy, I think. And she got arrested for smuggling drugs in the United States. She said later that she was doing lines of cocaine in front of him, and he would walk through the room and not see it. And if we're presuming that they weren't telling a story to keep him out of prison, that shows the level of denial. And I mean, I don't know about you, but I know that whenever I've been in a really, really bad relationship, there are so many things I can't see. And, you know, if any of my friends attempt to point them out to me, it's like, why are you trying to ruin my perfect relationship? And then once the thing's over, it's like, oh, my God, how did I not see that?
And the statistic says that a battered woman returns an average of 7 times to her batterer before she gets it together to leave.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, and that sort of leads to the next thing, or this kind of leads to the next thing, too. There's 2 more things about this. One of them is that R.D. Lang came up with the 3 rules of a dysfunctional family, which are also 3 rules of a dysfunctional culture. This is why we don't talk about it. It's rule A is don't. Rule A1 is rule A does not exist. And rule A2 is never discuss the existence or non-existence of rules A, A1, or A2. So what this means within the context, I mean, as you know, my own father is extremely violent. And when I was a child, we could talk about anything we wanted in the entire world except for my father's violence, which wasn't happening. And then, of course, we couldn't talk about the fact that we couldn't talk about my father's violence, because if we would have been talking about the fact that we couldn't talk about it, then there would have been some violence happening for us not to be talking about. But, of course, we had to pretend that the violence wasn't happening. We had to not see it. It had to disappear. And it's the same on the larger scale, where we can talk, you know, for years about you know, all sorts of trivia, Brad and Angelina and Jennifer Aniston and all this stuff, but we can't talk about the corporations that are killing the planet. We have to just sort of soldier on. And then this brings us to the complex PTSD thing, that most of us are aware of what post-traumatic stress disorder is. The normal PTSD is like if a woman is if something traumatic happens to you, things that remind you of that trauma can bring it back to you. So if a woman was raped in a certain make and model of car, if she sees that type of car, it can trigger her. Or there were beatings when I was a child. There were beatings associated with water skiing. And so, like when I was a teenager, if some friend would ask me to go water skiing, I would freak out. And instead of just saying, no thanks, I'm not really interested, I would totally flip. And that's because it would trigger that in me. It would take me back there, except I was entirely unaware. I was unconscious of that process. I just knew that I was terrified as soon as somebody mentioned water skiing. And that sort of PTSD can happen, I mean, with very specific incidents. But Judith Herman, who wrote this great book called Trauma and Recovery, said, what happens if someone is not traumatized once or twice, but instead is actually held in captivity for years? And that can be in prison, it can be in domestic violence, it can be through school. And what happens if you're systematically traumatized? And what she found is that then, instead of it simply being 1 or 2 triggers, that you can come to believe that all relationships are based on hierarchy, that mutual relationships aren't really possible. Relationships are based on dominance and submission. And you can come to believe that everything is scary, and so you can attempt to control everything. And so because the things that, I mean, if something's very scary, of course you've got to control it, because it could attack you at any moment. So if you're traumatized in that way, you can become incredibly closed off emotionally and incredibly controlling. And that, of course, is what we see on this large scale. My indigenous friends have said to me that the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that even the most open-minded Westerners generally view listening to the natural world as a metaphor as opposed to the way the world really works. And the way Thomas Berry puts this is that the world is not made of objects to be exploited, but instead subjects with whom we should enter into relationship. And so we've all been so terrified and traumatized by this culture that we can't even conceptualize anymore the notion of entering into a conversation with a tree, of listening to what a river might have to say. Oh, rivers and trees don't speak. And that's really, really central to everything, because there's a great line by a Canadian lumberman: when I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And if when you look at trees, you see dollar bills, you're going to treat them one way. And if when you look at trees, you see trees, you'll treat them another way. And if when I look at this tree right here, I see this tree right here, I'll treat it differently still. The same is true, of course, for fish. You know, if when I look at salmon, I see dollar bills, that's one thing, blah, blah, blah. And the same is true, of course, for women. If when I look at women, I see orifices, I'm going to treat them one way. If when I look at women, I see women, I'll treat them another way. If when I look at this particular woman, I see this particular woman, I'll treat her differently still. And so our whole culture has traumatized us to the point where we're so terrified to actually see these others as individuals with whom we can and should enter into relationship. And one of the ways this plays out on the larger scale, with the whole culture being traumatized like this, is the best way to control something is if it is uniform or as if it's dead. And that's one reason why this culture has killed the forest, is because A, it perceives them as resources to be exploited, and B, because it needs to manage them, it needs to control them, as opposed to simply letting them be. I mean, how strange a notion is that, to actually let a river be? No, you have to put in this concrete straitjacket. You know, there's 2 million dams in this country. There's 60,000 dams over 6 feet tall, and 70,000, I'm sorry, over 13 feet tall, 70,000 dams over 6 feet tall.
So,
and that's
Derek,
a lot. Carrying
the abuser metaphor, there is, down towards the end stage of being an abuser, the idea that if I can't have her, nobody else can, and translating that to societal violence, if I can't rule the planet, nobody else will either.
Yeah.
And you're right that we are in the thrashing endgame of civilization. So talk about you coping with fear, legitimate grief, sometimes overwhelming rage, despair, and staying functional.
Huh. Well, yeah, that's a really, really important question. And I think the way that I talk about that is that, and I usually say this at my talks too, this is a pretty important story. A few years ago, I got a call from a friend of mine who was working on toxic issues, pesticide issues here in Northern California. She called up and said, you know, this work is so hard. I'm just falling apart. It's breaking my heart. And it's killing me. And I said, yeah, I know it'll do that. And then she said, you know, this culture hates everything, doesn't it? I said, yeah, it does, even itself. And she said, it has a death urge, doesn't it? Just wants to destroy things. I said, yeah, it does. And she said that unless it stops, it's going to kill everything on the planet, isn't it? I said, yeah, it is, unless it stops. And then she said, we're not going to make it some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? And I thought a moment, and then I said the best thing I could possibly say, which is, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason that was the best thing I could possibly say is because 12 or 13 years ago, I was undergoing a similar collapse, where I was just crying all the time. And a lot of my environmentalist friends were saying, you know, just take a break, Derek. You know, the problems will be here when you come back. But I knew I needed to not take a break. I mean, I needed to just keep pushing, because if you're not going to cry about the death of this family, what are you going to cry about? You know, what do tears mean? And one day I was talking to this American Indian friend of mine, Jeanette Armstrong, and I was just crying, and I said, you know, this work is so hard, it's breaking my heart, it's killing me. And she said, yeah, it'll do that. And then I said, you know, the dominant culture hates everything, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it does, even itself. I said, it has a death urge, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it does. I said, unless it stops, it's going to kill everything on the planet, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it is, unless it stops. And then I said, we're not going to make it some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? And then she said the best thing she could possibly say, which is, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason that was the best thing she could possibly say is because it normalized my despair and let me know that despair is an appropriate response to a desperate situation. It let me know that the sorrow is just sorrow and the pain is just pain, and that I can feel all those things that wouldn't kill me. And, you know, that's one of the things, is there's this understanding or this idea that if you recognize, if you internalize how bad things are, if you really fully face that, then you have to be miserable all the time. But that's just not true. I mean, I'm full of rage, and I'm full of sorrow, and I'm full of joy, and I'm full of love. And I'm a complex enough being that I can hold in my heart the understanding that we are really, really, really screwed, and that life is really, really good. Life is so wonderful, and the trees are so beautiful, and I've got wonderful friends, and I'm really, really happy. And we're really screwed. And, you know, you can't, it's not, we're allowed to feel more than one thing at a time. And that's part of it, is that to recognize that I can feel those things. And it's not even so much the sorrow or even the pain that hurts, it is my resistance to it. They're just feeling. And
I have grown very fond of saying that my activism is my antidote to despair, that the minute I quit being active, it's going to swell up and absolutely overwhelming.
Yep.
So
exactly.
There's a new piece of that, becoming an enemy of the state. Certainly reading your book, you are advocating things that no habeas corpus, you could get extremely renditioned.
I don't think they're going to do that right now because they're winning. And as soon as they stop winning, I'm dead.
Okay. So talk about symbolic resistance versus action. The difference, you know, we've marched and in a a nice, safe civil disobedience step over the line stuff. And I am coming more and more to think of that as just a safety valve to burn off some steam so we can keep on living with the status quo. And I'm starting to really worry about that.
I think that, I mean, I got no problem, by the way. I need to say this, I got no problem with doing marches and holding signs and everything. I think one of the things that we often forget is that there is a difference between symbolic and non-symbolic actions. And I'm not going to diss symbolic or non-symbolic actions, just we need to recognize the difference. And a symbolic action would be something that's primarily meant to convey a message. Writing a book would be a symbolic action. Holding a sign is a symbolic action. And to jump to a different culture here, not a different culture, but a different time and different government, there were many plots against Hitler. And the German resistance to Hitler recognized that Hitler needed to die. And that's not a symbolic act. He physically needed to die in order for Nazism to be stopped. And I'm not saying, by the way, that the only non-symbolic actions are murder. I'm in no way saying that. You could have some people could liberate some cats from a vivisection lab. And that could have symbolism in terms of, you know, rallying people, and it also liberates those particular cats who are not symbolic. They are cats whose lives are no longer full of torment. And the thing, it's like people, you know, I talk a lot about dam removal and how there's, okay, that's a really important thing, that, okay, what do salmon need to survive? Salmon need for basically six things to happen in order for them to survive. They need for dams to be removed. They need for industrial logging to stop. They need for industrial fishing to stop. I'm not saying logging and fishing. I'm saying industrial logging and industrial fishing. I'm not saying subsistence. Very clear on that. Anyway, they need for dams removed. They need for industrial logging to stop, industrial fishing to stop. They need for global warming to stop, which means they need the industrial economy to stop. They need for the oceans not to be murdered. And they need for industrial agriculture to stop because of runoff. And those are all straightforward technical tasks. If they were space aliens who had come down and they were putting in all these dams, if they were putting, you know, doing all this stuff, we would know what to do. If it was Islamo-fascists who had invaded the United States and who were systematically killing the salmon, we would know what to do. But because we don't recognize that the government right now, the government is a government of occupation, because we don't recognize that, we, you know, hold our placards and everything. And once again, I'm not saying anything wrong with holding placards, but at some point, holding a sign or writing a book doesn't do anything for salmon by itself. At some point, dams need to come down. At some point, industrial logging needs to stop because of the sedimentation, etc. And at some point, things need to change. Physical things in the real physical world. And the question is, how do we achieve those? And once again, you can do many things through symbolic action, and there are things you can't do through symbolic action. And I think the thing we really need to ask ourselves, a really, really important thing, is to ask, what do you want? And most of us don't have any idea what we want. Do we want smaller clear cuts, kinder clear cuts? Do we want to, you know, do we want for the Cardinals to win the World Series? You know, what do we want? And I'm really, really clear on what I want. And what I want is to live in a world that has more wild salmon every year than the year before, and that has more migratory songbirds every year than the year before, that has less dioxin every mother's breast milk every year than the year before, that has, I want to live in a world that has great apes. I want to live in a world that has marlins and sharks. I want to live in a world that has angel sharks who are critically endangered. I want to live in a world with prairie dogs. I want to live in a world with polar bears. And I'll do what it takes to get there. And the question becomes, what do we need to do? And once again, many of those actions can be symbolic, and many of them can be non-symbolic. But I think we need to think really hard. First off, what do we want? And second, how are we going to go about getting it? And we have to recognize that there is nothing more important than our land base. Because once again, without a land base, you don't have anything.
So we're talking with author Derek Jensen. And Derek, I'd like to ask you to talk a little bit about the question of violence. Activists debate, squabble, fight, over what is peaceable, appropriate. I think you wrote the most critical issue of our time is what we should be doing to bring it down.
Right. And part of the reason that, okay, the book has many, many premises, and that I state explicitly. And one of the most important premises, I think, is that this culture is based on a rigidly defined, yet often unarticulated hierarchy. And violence done by those higher on the hierarchy to those lower is fully rationalized or often invisible. And violence done by those lower on the hierarchy to those higher is met with shock, horror, and the fetishization of the victims. And it's usually unthinkable, though, but when it does happen, it's met with those. And there's bazillions of examples of that. I mean, you know, within an abusive... I mean, my father could beat anybody he wanted with impunity, but the one time my brother fought back, he was beaten far worse than any other time because he committed blasphemy, essentially. He'd sent violence up the hierarchy. And cops are allowed to commit violence with impunity, pretty much. And there's a great example. This is a perfect example. This guy in Oklahoma beat his wife to death, got 7 years. And as he was being, as he was going through the trial process, he spat on a cop. And for that, he was sentenced to life in prison because he sent violence up the hierarchy. And so I think one of the things we need to do is to, well, that's one of the things first is we really need to think about the whole, we need to come up with some definitions of violence. I mean, I've had pacifists say to me that they're against all violence. It's like, okay, does that mean you never defecate? Because every time you defecate, of course, you're killing bazillions of bacteria. Does that mean you never eat? I mean, there is violence all the time. And the question becomes, what forms of violence are we against? And I'm not saying that all violence is good, but what my point is, you can't say all violence is bad, because then what you're saying is no one ever, ever is going to eat. And so first off, we should try to think clearly about this and start to define what is violence. And, I mean, people talk a lot about so-called eco-terrorists and how, you know, they're doing these acts of violence. It's like, no, they're not. I mean, they're burning down an empty building. That's not an act of violence. That's an act of sabotage. It's an act of arson. But that's not an act of violence unless you are an animist who believes that the building is alive. And we can have that whole other discussion. But anyway, the point is, let's start thinking clearly about violence and thinking about when violence may or may not be appropriate. And it's like part of the reason, one of the reasons I wrote that whole section on pacifism in there is because when I've done talks where I talk about violence at all, the response by the audience was really, really predictable. And that's a lot of sort of mainstream activists and peace and social justice activists would put up what I've taken to calling a Gandhi shield, which is they would sort of say the names Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Dalai Lama again and again to just keep all sorts of evil thoughts at bay. And then different groups would have entirely different responses, like prisoners or family farmers or survivors of domestic violence or American Indians, many of them, or a lot of poor people of color. A lot of them would look at me like, tell us something we don't know. And I realized that the difference was that for these latter groups, violence is not some abstract or spiritual question to be puzzled through. It's simply a part of life that you deal with. It doesn't mean you do it yourself, and it doesn't mean you don't do it. It means it's just part of life. And the thing that started to really bother me was that a lot of the lines that are thrown out by pacifists, dogmatic pacifists especially, they don't make any sense. Like you always hear, you can't use a master's tool to dismantle the master's house. And, well, first off, the people who say that have never read the essay from which it comes, because it has nothing to do with pacifism. And second, as much as I love Audre Lorde, she never built a house, because it doesn't matter whose tools you use. It's a nonsensical metaphor. I can use anybody's tools to dismantle the master's house. And besides which, it presumes, A, that violence is one of the master's tools, and B, that it's the master's house. But I want to talk about the whole master's tools thing, that's not... Those in power tell us that they own the land. They tell us they own the water. They're trying to tell us they own the air. They're trying to tell us they own genetic materials. And they want to tell us that they own violence, too. I don't think that mother grizzly bears are going to agree with that. Or another one I get all the time, that if you really loved enough, if you just loved enough that you would never even consider any act of violence, the idea that love implies pacifism. And once again...
That's also a domestic violence victim's response.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I said that's also a response from a domestic violence victim. If I just loved enough...
Oh, exactly. Exactly. But that's just nonsense. Because, I mean, I grew up in the country, and in my life I've been attacked by mother horses, cows, geese, chickens, dogs, cats, hummingbirds, spiders, mice, hawks, eagles, who thought I was attacking their babies. And if a mother mouse is going to take on somebody 6,000 times her size, I mean, once again, I don't think mother grizzly bears are going to agree that love implies pacifism. And there's one more of these I want to talk about real quick about the whole pacifism thing that I guess two more real fast. One of them is the notion that if you fight back, you run the risk of becoming like they are. And that's just nonsense. I mean, does that mean that the woman who fights back against her rapist runs the risk of becoming a rapist? Does that mean that Tecumseh ran the risk of becoming like the people who were stealing their land? Does that mean that a tiger who fights back against a zookeeper runs the risk of becoming a zookeeper? And then one other is they say violence never accomplishes anything. And that's just really obscene, because what that implies is all the Africans who came over on the slave ships did so voluntarily. And it implies that the American Indians gave their land up voluntarily, that it wasn't taken from them by violence. And it implies that women, that half the population of the planet isn't terrified because of men's violence against women. There's a great line by Robin Morgan where she talks about anywhere in the world, any woman walking alone late at night, if she hears footsteps behind her, she has reason to be afraid. And she calls that the democracy of fear. And that's because of men's violence against women. Violence is incredibly effective. That's why those in power use it. And that doesn't mean, once again, I'll be really, really clear, that doesn't mean that we should use, I in no way, people say, do you advocate violence, Derek? And I say, no. I advocate putting all of our options on the table. I don't advocate violence any more than I advocate nonviolence. I advocate looking at our options and deciding reasonably, rationally, consciously what we want to do, not listening to Gandhi as a guide, not listening to me as a guide, not taking an outside moral system, but instead really determining for ourselves what is right.
Gandhi only had to overthrow the British Empire. We have to save the planet.
Well, and he also had a bunch of, we in the West don't like to talk about this, but there were also armed revolutions going on at the same time.
Yeah. This has been Derek Jensen. Thank you for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
Loves talking to you. You're in Portland. You're talking Friday night. You want to tell us about it?
Yeah. Well, I would if I knew very much about it. It's at Disjuncta, I think it is.
Disjuncta. Yeah, it's 2:30.
Something, East or West Burnside, I think.
Yeah, East Burnside, right under the east end of the Burnside Bridge, and a creative writing workshop on Saturday.
Yeah, I'm doing two, I'm pretty sure. One in the afternoon, one in the morning. And information about both those is at my website under the appearances section. So it's derekjensen.org, and then click on appearances, because I don't have the details memorized. Yeah, and it should be really fun. Are you going to make it?
I expect to see you on Friday night. I have another commitment on Saturday, some symbolic activism.
Mm-hmm. Which is very important.
Yeah, and we're having fun. It's Code Pink.
Oh, can I say one thing about that?
You bet.
You know, it's like protests. I don't understand why more people don't do them, because even if they don't really accomplish much, they're so much fun.
That's true.
It's just a gas, you know, to wander around and, you know, protest the circus or protest whatever it is you're going to protest.
And we have fun costumes, too. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing you tonight, and thank you so much. This is Martha Odom with Derek Jensen on KBOO, your community radio station. Thanks, Derek.
Well, thank you so much.
All right, and what a wonderful interview. Martha Odom speaking to Derek Jensen, who you can see this evening at Disjuncta. And now we're going to speak with Emily, and oh my God, some mystery, wonderful mystery green-haired woman to tell you why you should call 503-232-8818 right now and get your membership up to date at KBOO.
Now we have $100 for $120 membership. if you call right now at 503-232-8818, you can get Endgame, The Problem of Civilization and Resistance. V2 Resistance, is that just there? Am I crazy? Anyway, this is Derek Jensen's book. You just heard an interview with Derek Jensen by KABU volunteer Martha. And KABU is made up of volunteers, except, of course, for mystery people with green hair that might be staff. However, they're few and far between our staff. As a matter of fact, we only have 7 in a organization of 500 or more, because you can't pay people to do this, folks. It's kind of dangerous work.
It is dangerous work. And actually, we're talking about Endgame. It's a 2-volume set. It's Volume 1 is The Problem of Civilization, and Volume 2 is Resistance. My name's Lisa. My hair is green, and I'm going to make a symbolic action in just a couple minutes. But we need people to call before I take that symbolic action, Emily Young.
She's got a rope in her hand, and I don't know what it is.
I've got two ropes and green hair.
We do have this book, this Derek Jensen book. Those of you who are familiar with
it. It's two books. It's a 2-volume set.
Oh, it's a 2-volume set.
These books are like as big as a phone book. This is an incredible value. And, you know, Derek Jensen, this is very dangerous radio. You need to be realizing how dangerous this radio is. You're not going to hear about this, even on Air America, I dare say. So 503-232-8818 is the number to call. We need you to step up to the plate and call. We really are in the last stretch of this happy membership drive. So if you live in the gorgeous Columbia Gorge or the wonderful Willamette Valley, toll free for you, 1-877-500-KABU. I don't know, Emily, should I offer to do the symbolic act if people call?
I don't know. We did. Jeffrey already called and renewed from Portland. Daniel bought a gift membership for Laura, which I think is a lovely idea, Daniel. You're a great guy, or maybe gal. I don't know. Mason is a new member, and Jason is renewing. And we have another, until 10:30, another $500 matching grant. So if you call right now to help us round out our pledge drive, what do we call this? A membership drive?
It's a happy membership drive.
It is. It's all those things. 503, you will really frost our flakes. 232-8818, and they need frosting. Can I say that on the radio? I don't know if I can anymore.
No.
Can we talk about frosting flakes?
Oh! Anyway.
1-877-500 outside the Portland area, 5266. 1-877-500-5266. And Lisa, we have all sorts of gifties and things that people can get when they call in, but right now we've just heard Derek Jensen, and it's his 2-volume set, The Problem of Civilization and Resistance, when he talks about what it means to be civilized. And I wonder what it is that we need to do to, as George Lakoff says, kind of change the wording on that. You know, what is civilized, or what is humanity? KABU deals with a lot of these things. We have some little people here, and I think about the future of our little people and the kind of world that we're leaving them, and the oceans that we're leaving them, and things like that. And if this is important to you, and if it's important that our voices are being heard, and voices with similar missions and similar thought patterns are out there, if you agree with us, you need to call 503-232-8818 right now and then pledge your support in these last few hours of our pledge drive.
Also, we love it when people come in person. We're located at 20 Southeast 8th. In Portland, Oregon, that's on Southeast 8th, a half block south of Burnside. You know what gets me, Emily? By the way, 503-232-8818. The first place I ever even heard of global climate change was at KABU, okay? First place I ever heard of the World Trade Organization was at KABU. First place I ever heard of, Marlena Smith talking about secret government and how the FBI... You know what? Marlena Smith, that's a perfect example. This is Friday. Marlena is kind of the queen of Fridays, although she's got a work job. Yeah, she's got a work schedule. She can't always be here. But that was the first time I ever heard of all the ways that secret government, the FBI, the CIA, have basically controlled our society and other societies, too. These are the airways where I first started to understand how these things work. And when I listened, I listened to National Public Radio for years. I never heard about these things on National Public Radio.
I heard about Mad Cow on KABU. I heard it first from Emily Harris, who is a KABU volunteer.
Who is now a National Public Radio foreign correspondent.
She was in Baghdad and Berlin. I think she's in Berlin now.
Germany, yeah.
If not Greenland, I don't know. We've also got people like Andrew Stelter who've gone out there into the world and bring the news back to us. And not only that, they're bringing us the real news and the real story. Mm-hmm. And you're only really getting it here at 503-232-8818. When you call in now with your $100 minimum pledge and you get Endgame, Derek Jensen's book.
His 2-book set.
Sorry,
it's big. I'm saying it's bigger than a book. It's woo!
You know what? His books are huge,
They are.
Yeah, okay, so 503-232-8818, Endgame, The Problem of Civilization and Resistance. And we have just oodles and oodles of books and
happy
things
gifts,
like that.
Happy gifts.
Happy, wonderful things. But the real reason you call is because you want to make sure that this valuable resource continues to thrive and not just survive. Although survival, I find, can I say sexy? I think survival is sexy. And ideas like saving the angel shark, I can get behind an oxymoron like that because it's really important. The first place I heard about nitrogen in the oceans, KABU, right here on KABU. I heard about which I'd heard about smart dust before, but I'd heard about it in a different sort of way. And then these little chips that they're able to put in us and follow us around.
The RFID chips. Here's another thing I first heard about on KABU. It was the mad cow. What was it I was just going to say?
Prions.
Let's just give the phone number again.
You don't even want to know some of this stuff, but you know we need to know. And the interesting thing is you could say, remember when I was talking about that 5 years ago and you thought I was crazy?
Yeah, I've gotten that a lot.
We're not. And we actually, this is where we find our hope is right here at 503-232-8818, where I find better sleep at night because I knew I'm doing something. And I get that program guide.
Yeah, I also wanted to jump in here. I was listening. Martha Odom, right, did this interview with Derek Jensen. Martha Odom is an activist. One of the things I like about KABU is that we can be activists and be journalists at the same time. You know, we can actually give people a framework of what you should do. I mean, to me, that's what makes it not hopeless. When Martha's on the air saying, you know what, I found that my activism is an antidote to my hopelessness. Now, that's something I never hear anywhere else, ever. Ever. I mean, just to give people a sense that we can do something about it.
Katie Couric isn't out there. And the thing is,
she's getting Botox. She's doing this eyebrow thing. I don't know. I'm just putting that out there.
You know, a lot of your time is spent grooming people, and this is time to groom your inner self. You will look better on the outside. Your face will clear up. When you put that KABU sticker on your bicycle or on your bag or on even the bumper of your... Don't put it on your Hummer. I don't know. I just can't have you do that. But put it on the back of your Prius, maybe. How can I? Is that a conflict of interest for me to mention them? I don't drive one. I probably never will. Probably never can afford it.
503.
However, if you can afford at least a $60 membership right now at 503-232-8818, it's your way of making sure that this sort of information gets out. It's also a training ground for future reporters and future information gatherers to ensure our true freedom, if we can take that word back and not have it have a slimy, sleazy, slimy feel to it. I want that word back.
1-877-500-KABU. If you're outside the Portland area, that's toll free for you. Inside Portland, 503-232-8818. You know what? I just have to toss this out there. I know it's apropos of nothing. We're saving the planet. We're doing all that stuff, right, that we can. But here's another thing I just have to put out there. Boo ball. I know that's apropos of nothing.
Boo bash, boo ball.
We're having the biggest Halloween party in town on Halloween night. And for a $60 contribution to KABU, you get two pairs of tickets, plus the joy of being part of the tribe. Okay? We're inviting people to join the tribe. You know what, too? I'm ready to make a symbolic action.
I can describe it. We've got the rope. It's green hair. She's walking towards the table. She's lifting her skirt. She's hiking her skirt. Her boots are showing. Her striped toes are showing. Oh, my gosh. She is, ladies and gentlemen, she is lassoing the people answering the phones. You need to help them. You need to call now. 503-232-8818. Oh, my gosh, the humanity. And she's got green hair and striped hose. And you can come down to 20 Southeast 8th, and you, too, can be lassoed and into this. There's safety in numbers. And we need your numbers. We need the dollars. We need you to keep needles, actually, in our ancient turntables, which we always need to replace everything. So please call right now at 503-232-8818. Please support this treasure that is KABU. Thank you.
Oh, no.
All right, and thank you. And as Lisa stands and lassos on the table, we are going to move on to an interview with Aaron Yankee from KABU has interviewed Jason Renault of the Mental Health Association and Tom Antron of the Mental Health Advisory Board about the James Chassie killing. You can keep calling at 503-232-8818. Mm-hmm.
rides at all.
On September 17, 2006, James Chassie died from injuries sustained by Sergeant Kyle Nice and Officer Christopher Humphreys of the Portland Police and Deputy Brett Burton of the Multnomah County Sheriff's Department. This is Jason Renaud of the Mental Health Association of Portland.
I know Jim for about 25 years. What we know is that Jim was a person who liked to wander and walk the streets. And he was doing that about 5:30 on September 17th. Now, a lot of the facts we know about the case, we need to sort of preface it by saying that these are facts reported to us now by police officers who are involved in the assault. Those facts haven't been verified by an outside independent source. So what we know is somehow the police officers encountered Jim, and Jim did not comply with what they instructed him to do, and I think that's safe to say, that he was spooked or walked off or did something non-compliant. The police officers then somehow got into a scuffle with him, knocked him down, dragged him around a bit from the looks of the autopsy, and then beat him by kicking him in the chest and kicking him in the head. Now, the law states clearly that a kick to the head is lethal force. These officers and the sheriff's deputy who are involved, there are three individuals, face some jeopardy, certainly from the district attorney, if not from a civil suit. Chase was hogtied, which meant that his wrists were handcuffed behind his back, and his ankles were handcuffed, and his ankles and wrists were lashed together somehow. So he was in an arched position and left on the ground. We believe from witnesses that he was semi-conscious or unconscious for some duration. When the ambulance arrived, the ambulance driver or witnesses reported that he shouted out, "Don't leave me alone. Don't leave me alone," was quoted in the papers. Somehow it was decided that the ambulance should not take him to the hospital, but that instead a police squad car should take him to jail. Squad car took him to jail. Someone instructed the police officers, we're not sure who brought Jim in, and we're not sure how he was brought in, whether he was still shackled or not, that he was too badly injured to come to jail, that they instead should take him to the hospital. According to reports in the paper, the police officers then brought him back to the squad car, not an ambulance, and proceeded to try to drive him to Adventist Hospital, to a psychiatric ward, not an emergency room, and not the closest hospital. Adventist Hospital from the Portland jail is over 100 blocks, and it was rush hour on a weekday. At some point in the drive, police officers decided that Jim was dead. They pulled off, I think, Banfield and called for an ambulance. At that point, Jim was taken by ambulance to the coroner's office in Clackamas County. There is an autopsy report that was made public by the family. That's on our website, which is www.mentalhealthportland.org. It's rather grisly, and anyone who's interested in how organizations like the county come to decisions they do should take a look at it. It's very educational. What we also know about Jim is that he had schizophrenia, and he'd had it for a long time. It's an illness that makes communication confusing and difficult. Jim was a very quiet person, a very shy person, a person who did not like to be confronted, did not like to be noticed. To be shouted at by a police officer or to be commanded would, for Jim, it would be a normal response for him to run away, not to follow commands.
This interview with Jason Renaud and Tom Entron was conducted October 15th here at KBOO.
before the grand jury decided not to return criminal charges against the three officers.
Well, I'm Jason Renaud, and I'm a volunteer with the Mental Health Association of Portland. And we've been acting as advocates, helping people with mental illness and in recovery speak up and speak out for about 3 years now. In 2005, we did an advocacy program around the Oregon State Hospital, trying to talk about how the state hospital had treated people over time. We found that there were a large number of patient remains that were left in the hospital by staff, which had been interred and then had been uninterred and left in a closet in an abandoned building. And we took that fact and talked about it a lot, brought people to the hospital, brought people to the issue, got legislators and politicians and bureaucrats thinking about the hospital, sometimes for the first time in their careers. I think we were very successful in educating folks about the hospital. Now the rebuilding of the hospital and the changing of the clinical model are top on everyone's minds, number one on the agenda in the upcoming legislative session. In 2006, we had been looking for a case where an individual had been hurt somehow because of the lack of communication between the city and the county and the various bureaucracies. The case of Jim Chase got very interesting to us quickly because some of our members knew Jim and had even provided care for him at times.
I'm Tom Antron, and I have had one clash with police. It is minor compared to some stories I have heard. I became interested in mental health advocacy through my own experiences, and also I am a member of the Multnomah County Adult Mental Health and Substance Abuse Advisory Council. Increasingly, as I read the stories about what police have done in cases of people with emotional difficulties and hearing people speak, I am horrified and I am very concerned.
It's an unusual finding that this would be described as an accident. There is a subset finding that the medical examiner can make, which is death by a law officer, where it's not uncommon that people die at the hands of law officers, and so they do have a special definition for that. It's interesting that she would come to that conclusion, especially since all that she uses to come to her conclusion is the physical evidence of the body and the clothing, not the events leading up or leading away. According to the autopsy report, 26 ribs were cracked, splintered, or broken. He had contusions all over his body, been dragged through the over gravel. He had been kicked in the head. He had massive internal injuries, died within 20 minutes after the beating. An accident for most people would be falling off a ladder or sticking your finger in an electric plug, not being beaten at the hands of the police. One of the bright lights of this process so far is that the district attorney has said that he will turn over the grand jury findings to the family, which is, I think, unprecedented, as far as I know, when in a case like this. I suppose that some sort of strategy to say, listen, we want to do the right thing here. What do we do to make it right? And one thing the city can do is not defend itself ridiculously.
I don't care what he did. Whether it's truthful, and from what I hear, it's not, that he urinated in public. It doesn't matter. So what? That does not give a police officer the excuse to beat him to death. And I, too, am shocked that such a verdict of accidental death comes up. In one sense, I'm not shocked, because people are afraid to stand up against the police officers. However, this is what it takes. It would take courageous people to stand up. It was no accidental death. You do not beat someone on the chest and call it an accidental death.
Again, this is Jason Renaud of the Mental Health Association of Portland.
There's a lot of ways that the system doesn't work, and let's say what the system is. Systems can be both mapped and administrated, bureaucratic systems. By anyone's understanding of Portland's mental health system, it can't be mapped or administrated. There's a huge amount we don't know about. We don't know how much money is spent on it. Even though people have been looking at that problem for a long time, they're not really sure about that. When you consider that mental health services are provided by the county from the Aging Services Department, from the Mental Health Services Department, from the Addiction Services, from the Health Department, from the city's Housing Department, and the Low-Income Shelters, which are two different departments, and from the jails, and from the Parole and Probation, and from private contractors such as Cascadia and LifeWorks, and from private hospitals such as Good Samaritan or Emmanuel, and from hundreds, perhaps thousands, of private practitioners. None of those people communicate in any sort of effective way with each other. Communication actually stops people from getting killed.
I agree. Communication is a huge problem. It's even a problem between a doctor and a patient on a regular basis. Although I have been told that medical schools are changing and teaching communication more, that's long overdue, and it needs to be speeded up. On this advisory council, there is a police officer who is the head of the CIT, the Crisis Intervention Team. He was saying that increasing number of police officers are taking this course, which includes people who use the mental health services. They go and speak to the police about their experiences. This is not enough. Every single police officer needs to be trained. I feel personally that the problem is people are afraid. They're afraid because they do not understand what the problem really is. A lack of education underlies fear. From my own experiences, fear can trigger greater problems. The policeman who approached me, for example, was twice my size, and when I asked him if I could stand up, he said no, I might attack him. To me, it's nonsense, and if I was a really disturbed person, those very words would have provoked me. Listening to Jason tell the story, it sickens my stomach. It really makes me ill. It is clear that there needs to be further training and learning how to speak compassionately, being able to calm themselves so that they can calm the other person.
Taman talked about this crisis intervention training. This is a great program that's been up and running here for about 5 years, started in Memphis about 10 years ago. Seattle does it, San Francisco does it, lots of cities. It's 40 hours of pretty intense training. They hear from psychologists, psychiatrists, people who have mental illness, people with addiction, family members, all sorts of folks. But it's a voluntary program.
Mm-hmm.
It's a voluntary program, which means that by nature it does not get to the people who need it the most. It gets it to the people who want it the most. That's a great place where the city can make a very small adjustment, but an important adjustment to change things real quick. Because it's that experience of talking to people with a mental illness, knowing people personally, that reduces that fear inside of yourself. You find it not contagious.
Mm-hmm.
They're just normal people with a little different part of them.
The
people who are able to maintain their compassion throughout the sort of indoctrination of being a police officer or a soldier often find themselves pushed up the administrative hierarchy fairly quickly. They are typically more capable individuals in dealing with lots of different types of people, and those make good leaders. And unfortunately, those people, they get the CIT training because they want it, and then they get promoted, and they're off the streets. It's really the youngest guys and the people who are, as Taman talked about, afraid. It's that fear that makes you do these stupid things. And that training can help that fear dissipate, mm-hmm. and meeting people. It's perhaps a dangerous task, opening up the heart of a policeman, because then you might not have a policeman anymore when it's all done. But we had a term that we used in the 19th century called gunslinger. A gunslinger. And this city is too complicated and too large and too cosmopolitan to have gunslingers in it anymore. There's just too many people who don't speak English or don't comport themselves to police demands for whatever reason, because their brain is different, because their culture is different. And if we have a bunch of gunslingers running around, it's not a safe place for anybody. You didn't have to be mentally ill like Jim to get beaten to death in downtown Portland. If anything comes of this, you know, there might be a civil suit and there might be a criminal trial. But what's most important, I think, is really in the hands of the mayor and the police chief right now, and not in the hands of the courts at all. Because the best outcome, the best memorial for Jim here would be justice. In this circumstance, justice is people to feel safe in public. Mm-hmm. People who have these different communications, different cultures, different kinds of brains, that they feel safe walking downtown, and they feel that when they call a police officer, that that person is going to comport themselves in a respectable way. And that family members who have folks with mental illness can call on the police for help in a crisis, and not feel that that police officer is going to be more dangerous than the crisis. The police chief, Rosie Sizer, and Mayor Tom Potter are really on the button right now. Just a very few words, they could reassure us and give us some of that trust back. They are going to need to say those words next week. If they don't say those words, I think we need to be a lot more careful. And people who have mental illness and family members, they really are going to have a hard decision about whether they can trust police officers. This case is going to go on for a long time. How the city responds to this event is going to be very interesting. And how the civil suit responds to this event will be interesting. A lot of the people who have been involved in mental health politics for a long time do believe deep in their hearts that the civil action is probably the most effective way of changing policy. That's a sad commentary on the bureaucracy, the public administration of these programs, but it is probably the most efficient at this point way of getting everybody's attention. How that occurs and how we as the public know about it, and how the county and the city and the private contractors to the county and the city respond to it is going to be very interesting.
Friday, October 27th at 7 p.m. at the First Congregational Church in Portland, 1126 Southwest Park Avenue. Friends, family, and concerned community members will gather to remember James Chassie Jr. in a memorial vigil. The event is being coordinated by members of the Chassie family, the Park Rose Community United Church of Christ, Portland Cop Watch, the Mental Health Association of Portland, and others. For more information, call Portland Cop Watch at 503-236-3065. And for more information about James Chassie, go to www.mentalhealthportland.org. This is Erin Yankee.
And a wonderful piece by Aaron Yankee. You can call now at 503-232-8818 to support great programming like that. And now we're going to go to our membership drive and see how things are going.
Things are going splendidly. Patricia, Claudia, and Angela all called in. Patricia was from Troutdale. Claudia's from Salem. And Angela was from Portland, all called in to renew and renew their membership with KABU, which is a beautiful thing. Also, right now, we still have that matching grant going, but we only have it going for 5 more minutes. We have 5 more minutes for up to a total of $500 will be matched by an anonymous KABU member. And you can become a member, too, right now. Please call 503-232-8818. Or 1-877-500-KBOO. Brian Coombs is with me here right now. Brian's also a volunteer at KABU.
That's right.
Brian, we were just hearing about Jim Chassie, who is, of course, the young man that was just beaten to death. And we probably aren't hearing a lot about that anywhere else. And that's the type of stuff you get here on KABU, ain't it?
That's exactly right. That's the kind of thing that you hear here on KABU, and I can't hear myself in my headphones, but that's okay. It's no matter. I know you're hearing me out there. Yeah, you will hear about the James Chassie case elsewhere, but it will be it won't be the real story. You know, it'll be confused and at least in my opinion obfuscated and tainted by the story that you would read in the daily paper, not necessarily the whole story. So at KABU, you get a full spectrum of information here.
That's right. We don't just glaze over it, and it's not just a two-minute story. We just had virtually, 25 solid minutes where Aaron Yankee produced this story. We always are running similar stories like this at KABU. If you want to support this sort of program, if you'd like to become a member of KABU and receive the program guide and know when programs like this will be aired, then you need to call 503-232-8818 for a $120 membership. That's only $10 a month. We can have it pulled out of your account automatically. You may not even feel that. A lot of people suggest to commit to 1 hour of your wage a month, and I think it's a great idea. So whatever that comes out to be, sign up for that and have that taken out of you. How do you support KABU, Brian?
I pay a penny a day.
A penny a day?
Absolutely, and that works out to be $3.65. No, actually, I'm a little bit more of a member than that. Penny a day is very low income. No, actually, I pay it once a year. I just put it on my plastic because, hey, who cares?
I do, too. I pay it all at once, when I can. And actually, I try to call in for every drive that we have, every membership drive. But right now, we're narrowing down. We only have 2 minutes left in that matching $500. And I'm not sure if we've made it yet. We haven't. We need to raise a couple more dollars to make that happen. You only have a few minutes to call. Please call right now, 503-232-8818. That's 503-232-8818. If you were going to call and make a pledge of support during this pledge drive, right now, in these next few minutes, is the time to do it. Also, we have that matching grant. We really need you, actually, to call right now, 503-232-8818. We really like it when you do.
We love to hear the phone ring. If you're outside the local dialing area, it's a toll-free call, 1-877-500-5266. Just a couple of minutes left, friends. It's so close. We're right on the edge of making our goal and finishing the drive, and we've had to extend it a couple of days, which is all right, but when we get to our goal, we quit. That's it. We're done. So help us, put us over the top, finish this out in good style. 503-232-8818.
Yeah, be the person that puts us over the top and be the real just the flash in the pan that we all that blinds us. 503-232. Oh, there they are.
That could be it.
503-232-8818. I saw a couple of chihuahuas today in the front of a car, and I don't know why that.
Do you think they're members?
I just was really charmed by their expression and everything like that. And I'm just kind of challenging chihuahua owners out there right now to step up to the plate for KABU. In the next minute, we have one minute, actually less than a minute.
503-232-8818.
So exciting. I know those are the chihuahua people.
7-7-5-2-6-5.
If you can find something.
500-5-2-6-6.
Oh, really good. Really great. And we're going to go to Boneheads and Bigots, I think. I hopefully this will put us over the top. Are we going to Boneheads and Bigots how much more time do we have?
Well, we probably have about 20 seconds.
I have un poco time. One more call.
an outside caller, a Chihuahua owner in Salem or Troutdale. 1-877-500-5266.
That would do it.
I don't know why the affinity for the Chihuahua for me, but perhaps it is my
I used to have one of the fake Chihuahuas in the back with a head that bothered.
Doesn't count, right?
Oh, damn.
503-232-8818.
Do it now, and thank you very much, everyone who's called.
Good morning and welcome to Boneheads and Bigots. This is Pat McGuire. I am your anti-fascist radio activist, as usual. Hey, today we have a really special show here for Pledge Drive, and we've got on the phone a great person I want to interview. And if we have any time, we'd love to take some calls, so listen closely and get close to your phones. We've got Abby Scher on the line. She is a contributor to In These Times, so you can check out an article that she's written recently about the fundamentalist Christian right. And she is the editor of The Public Eye. You could check that out at www.publiceye.org. It's quarterly on the U.S. right that's published by the think tank Political Research Associates. They're out of Massachusetts. And The Public Eye was recently nominated for a 2006 Utney Independent Press Award. Abby, are you there?
I'm here.
Great. It's wonderful to have you on the show, and in particular, the article that I just checked out that's on the In These Times website about that's called Face to Face with the Fundamentalist Base is completely interesting and very, very scary. It talks about the Values Voters Summit that just recently happened in D.C., and can you tell us a little bit about that to provide some context for us?
Sure. The Values Voters Summit was sponsored by a coalition of Christian right groups, and they're the lobby groups, so they're not the 501c3s, they're 501c4s, and so they have a little more latitude in the politics that they do, and the goal of the summit was to mobilize folks at the Christian right base to get Republicans elected. Of course, they can't say Republicans explicitly, but they talk about conservatives. And in fact, there was some discomfort with the Republican Party there that the leaders had to confront and deal with and speak to. But really the goal was to get conservatives elected.
Now, this was put on by the Family Research Council, right?
Uh-huh. It's actually FRC Action, the Family Research Council Action. That's what I mean. Okay. FRC.
Oh, they're PAC then.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're
PAC. So it's their lobby group. And one interesting thing is that the Family Research Council has supplanted the Christian Coalition as the organization of the Christian right and the powerhouse, the political powerhouse in Washington. So they're very important. They're the ones that really cut the deals. And the summit opened with Dr. James Dobson, who's the head of Focus on the Family. It's a huge evangelical group out of Colorado that, in fact, founded the Family Research Council.
Yeah,
and James Dobson opened by saying, well, I've spent 2 weeks, I was touring the offices of Washington, meeting with Republicans and realizing, yes, even though we're not totally happy with them and they haven't enacted our agenda as much as we would like, we have no choice. We have to work on their behalf.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because there's a picture of Tony Perkins, the head of FRC's PAC, and he is really reminiscent of, you know, people who have been around this for a while. Ralph Reed, who used to run the Christian Coalition. You know, your young, you know, poster child with the close shave and, you know, the haircut and the red, you know, reptile kind of thing. But it sounds like the Values Voters Summit was about how it seemed to me, it sounded like it was how Republicans can deal with, or, you know, evangelical Christians, I should say, can deal with these social issues, wedge issues like gay rights and abortion and pornography to sort of get out the vote, and particularly the religious vote, for their candidates.
Well, it's definitely a pep rally hitting the notes against gay marriage, against abortion. And what was novel at this summit was the addition of a Republican talking point, which is the war on terror. And Dobson, in his opening remarks, said the war on terror is a family value, that we have to engage in the war on terror, be vigilant about it, because it's a family value and our families are at stake. So he and other speakers like Sean Hannity and Gary Bauer, who came up later, also hit that theme, and they basically said that we have to defeat the liberals in order to win the war on terror, that we have to fight the war against liberals at home because basically they're traitors, and they don't take seriously the threat of Al-Qaeda, and so we have to defeat them and the values that are their values that are destroying America in order to have the strength to beat Al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting how many, you know, people are running for office or interested in running office, you know, in the near future, or were there, you know, sort of getting their message right for that group to take to their churches and to their families and, you know, other units where they are. Mitch Romney, I guess, was there, right?
Oh, yeah. They had the whole parade of 2008 hopefuls from the Republican Party. And that's what the mainstream media actually paid attention to.
Mm-hmm.
They were really interested in that. And I went to cover a panel, a women's panel in the afternoon, and none of the mainstream media was filming at that point. They, as far as they were concerned, they're just interested in what the presidential candidates say. And in that way, they miss what the Christian right itself is saying.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we think that we understand the Christian right, but sitting there in the auditorium, I realized that I had a lot to learn.
Mm-hmm. What were the most surprising things that you picked up?
One thing was a real concern about the coarsening of the culture. That mm-hmm. was a phrase I heard from the vice president of FRC Action. And that her opposition to abortion came out of a sense of the coarsening of the culture. And another woman I interviewed, one who basically said, not basically, she directly said that gay parenting was a form of child abuse.
Wow.
Quite radical sentiment. But I asked her why she thinks support for her positions are growing, and she said, well, also because there were so many younger people there in their 30s and 40s, which surprised me, that mm-hmm. much younger demographic than the Christian Coalition mobilized. And she said when people have families and they have children and they face popular culture, suddenly they start realizing the sexualization of the culture and that they have to protect their children. And so they do try to create and participate in a counterculture. So that all of these things that to us seem kind of out there, for them, they really do see it as circling the wagons around their children.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that, I mean, was there a sense that people are inflamed by this is a threat to children more than the other, you know, issues that, you know, that we've been talking about? You know, they talk about the sexualization of the media and gay sex and, you know, women who are having abortions rather than raising children. Do you think it's really very, you know, the threat to children centric for all of these people here? Or is that sort of a political rallying point for them? You know, do you think that there's any...
Is it strategic or sincere?
Yes,
I guess.
Yeah.
I think it's both.
Good way to put that, Abby. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's both. But I definitely saw sincerity there. But I think that's true for all Americans.
Mm-hmm.
You foreground children, and I think everybody is going to start getting teary-eyed and worried.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that, in that sense... I mean, the issue is that by the coining the phrase family values, which really only emerged in the Christian right in the mid-90s, that bringing family values in, can they really speak on behalf of all families and speak on what the values of America should be?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's so frustrating.
Well, do you get the sense that this whole movement really got a boost from
the issue of all of the state initiatives this past major election that were on state ballots against gay marriage, and the jolt that the right got mobilizing from some really sort of inflammatory, you know, kind of the Willie Horton political statements that they were able to put out there that, you know, got people really inflamed and got them to the polls.
People go back and forth on that, mm-hmm. and there's a statistician, political statistician, John C. Green, who found that indeed in Ohio it did make a big difference. And he tries to evaluate how big a difference it played elsewhere, and it's less clear than in Ohio. But the overall atmosphere, you can't really calibrate or measure so easily the overall atmosphere that's created. And in that sense, I don't think there's any doubt. And how sincerely these folks are just outraged at gay marriage. But right before the summit, the People for the American Way policy arm issued a report that found that support for gay rights, specifically gay civil unions, has been increasing over the years. So the more that the Christian right is mobilizing around it, even though it works for mobilizing internally within their own movement, the rest of Americans are going the other way. And mm-hmm. I think that's really key here in terms of long-term strategy, of just seeing the weaknesses within the Christian right.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that the People for the American Way polls found is that opposition to abortion is still embraced by a majority of Americans, just over 50%, and that has remained stable. That hasn't shifted, which is good and bad, but it also shows that the Christian right mobilizing around that hasn't really...
It hasn't changed the political landscape.
No.
Uh-huh.
No.
Wow, that's really interesting. What about, you know, how does that break down when you talk about black evangelical Christians, or you talk about the black Christian right or Latino Christian right, or, you know, the non-white Christian right? Did that sort of break out differently than your majority white?
I interviewed two African Americans and one South African, actually. He's I guess they would call him colored. I don't know exactly mm-hmm. what the terminology is. But I definitely...
Wow,
heard,
South Africa's really come far, haven't they?
I heard something very different from the African-Americans that I interviewed. First of all, there weren't that many. It was a handful of people, which isn't true. They have regional summits, and I guess everyone's heard of the Promise Keepers, which are much more mixed. And these hardcore activists who are coming from other parts of the country were largely, almost entirely white.
Mm-hmm.
So the two African Americans I interviewed really had challenges to the Christian right. They were anti-abortion. They saw themselves as fundamentalists. They really thought that the Bible could be taken literally and gave a very clear moral direction on issues like abortion and gay marriage or gay rights at all. But they found that the Christian right, they felt some distance from them because they don't have a justice orientation. They mm-hmm. they weren't interested in justice. They weren't talking about poor people. And that for them, the Bible, that was a very important part of Jesus' teachings and the Bible as a whole, is concern about the least of us. And so the white Christian right is definitely reaching out to these folks. They want to mobilize the African Americans mm-hmm, who are conservative mm-hmm. on a religious basis, but you could hear that it's not entirely easy. Although in Ohio, John C. Green did find that some African American evangelicals did vote Republican.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting when you talk about that sort of split there about the, you know, Jesus's teaching about the least of us, and, you know, what are you going to do about people and the poor and their issues? I think it seems that there's a sense that the Christian right, the white Christian right, excuse me, is, you know, a fundamentalist bootstrap people, you know, that if you're poor, it's because you aren't trying hard enough, you know, the American
oh, yeah.
dream, you know, and you should be able to take advantage of the American dream. So I think
I was really shocked. I have mm-hmm. to say, I was shocked that poverty and none of those justice issues was mentioned. Mm-hmm. In 2 days of program, I didn't hear anything. And for a political rally to just bypass it entirely. And also, one woman I interviewed from the Southwest worked in an auto parts store. it's not as though she has a lot of money, and there were quite a few people there who came from modest backgrounds. And that might create a culture of resentment. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. They talked about, you know, you've heard before that Martin Luther King Jr. really got the, you know, the most dangerous when he was starting to make the connections on class issues between poor whites and poor blacks. And I think that's still part of it, you know, that I may be working in an auto parts store, but at least, you know, at least I'm not a black person. But nobody's going to say that, of course. But the interesting thing to me is how this whole war on terror thing has gotten into it. That you have to support the president, and then, you know, you have to defeat the liberals who aren't supporting the effort, the war effort. How do you think that plays out with the sense that this administration's kind of backpedaling most recently?
This group did not want the president to backpedal. They might be unhappy with the Republicans on other grounds that he, on stem cell research, he's waffling, but around the war on terror, he, as far as they're concerned, there was no trouble. One thing else that the People for the American Way study found was that there, even though over 20% of Americans are evangelicals, only 11% of Americans are traditionalist evangelicals. So the pool that these folks are coming from is actually a fairly small pool. So they're basically the vanguard, if I can borrow terminology. So they really are hardcore. They're very hardcore. And they gave great applause to Bill Bennett, the former education secretary under Reagan, when he supported waterboarding. So when Sean Hannity and Bill Bennett explicitly defended torture, that got a rousing response from the audience. And I must say, I was shocked. I didn't think that deeply religious people would support torture.
Yeah, it seems a little inconsistent, doesn't it?
I just was very surprised. And as a journalist sitting in the audience, one speaker got a standing ovation around going after journalists who are revealing the civil liberties abuses of the Bush administration. And the woman in back of me, here I am sitting down with my notebook, and she was saying, "Kill them! Kill them all!" Meaning the reporters, and it was quite an experience.
Well, I guess that's a nice change from kill the lawyers. Speaking of the lawyer, but so did you get outed as a journalist there? Or did you? Could you just?
I was there as a journalist.
Okay.
And I was working with a radio person. We were interviewing people with a microphone, and I did a radio report on this. I had press credentials, and I made no secret of where I was coming from. And the name of the show I was doing the report for, Making Contact, is kind of anonymous.
And tell us a little bit about that.
Well, next week, Making Contact is broadcasting this half hour, and it's the interviews that I did with the Christian right base that was there, but also we're broadcasting a whole bunch of the speeches from the podium. And there's not a lot of my analysis, because I really thought, and I think, people should listen and hear the way that I heard what folks are really saying, because it feels very distant in our media, in the progressive media. We're very clear about where we stand and what our analysis is, but if you don't listen, then you won't hear this new argument about the war on terror. There are two wars. One is on the liberals, and one is against the terrorists. I hope people listen next week, because
Well, that seems like a really a good thing to have, and you know, we could have used this a lot earlier. You know, people sort of making that connection, and, you know, getting the information out there instead of sort of shaping it and soundbiting it. You know, the surprise that people had after the last presidential election, like, I just didn't know that people, you know, were so different than, you know, thought so differently than I thought, that kind of thing. Or we're not going to know that unless we actually sit down and talk to each other about these issues.
There's also common ground, I heard, which surprised me. I mean, maybe when you're progressive and the rest you feel kind of isolated. Well, these folks feel isolated. I mean, to us, since they seem to be rising in power, you wonder how the Christian right can feel isolated, but they definitely express that. Also, there was a lot of talk not about Republican politicians, where people didn't have a lot of good things to say in general about politicians, but about the need for statesmen, for leaders, for people that you could trust. And in the People for the American Way poll, they also said that was the number one concern of voters of all varieties, that they wanted trustworthy people in office. And the whole skepticism about politics and the power structure, even though they're embracing it wholeheartedly, that was really interesting to me. And also, there was a lot of divergence around gender.
Mm-hmm.
So that there were some women who really were egalitarian and uh-huh. expected a certain kind of egalitarian treatment. And then there were the traditional family, I want my husband to protect me kind of folks.
Mm-hmm.
But to see, even though people bashed feminists, to see the extent to which so many of the women there just assumed
that they would have some role to play.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'd say about 40% of the people there were women. The people who identified themselves as political candidates from the audience in local elections were women.
Mm-hmm.
There were women among them. And that was interesting to me. And I don't think people talk about that too much. And then a third issue where you saw some cleavages was around immigration, where the vice president of FRC Action said, wow, we put someone on the podium to talk about immigration. And he spoke about his Irish immigrant grandfather coming and how the Bible says that you have to protect the alien because we were once strangers in Egypt. And he supported the guest worker program, mm-hmm. which is sort of a compromise. That's not the far right position.
Right.
And here he was the first speaker, Mike Pence.
Mm-hmm.
He's a congressman. And I asked Connie Mackey, the vice president of FRC Action, about that. I said, wow, I was really surprised to hear this position, which was a very modulated position. And in fact, the audience didn't give him great applause for it. And it seemed unusual for FRC Action not to be throwing red meat to their members to try to get them motivated. And she says, well, we are only taking this on now. We're still exploring it because our base is interested in it, and we're still trying to figure out where we are. So there are issues in flux for the movement. And you got the feeling that things are changing outside of their hallways, and they're trying to figure out what to do with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, the PRA is going to have a report out on their website, by Chipperley and Pam Chamberlain, that's called Running Against Sodom and Osama, The Christian Right, Values Voters, and the Culture Wars in 2006. And that should be coming out, excuse me, any time in the next couple of days here. But I looked at a early version of it, and one of the things that I thought was the most interesting and also the most scary was a section on micro-targeting in the pews and Connie Marshner's strategies. Can you talk a little bit about, didn't she give a workshop on voter identification and turnout?
Oh, this was so bold. It was so bold. Connie Marshner is a political operative. She has a background in training people to work on behalf of candidates. She's been doing it for over 10 years. And she had a workshop for church people and told them, in order to mobilize candidates to take their church lists and pretend to be someone else, to be a pollster, and to call them. It, basically a form of push polling,
mm-hmm.
from the pulpits. First of all, you're not supposed to campaign with church rolls, and church people as a group are not supposed to be promoting candidates. So she was suggesting that they violate the law,
mm-hmm.
break the law. And obviously, since this was her strategy, this is what she's promoted in the past. She's a political strategist.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some disagreement in the audience. I have to say it was started by some of the progressives who were in the audience just listening and raised their hand and said, wow, isn't this illegal? but then the other folks in the audience said, yeah, you know, they did not get on board with that. So you did see this split between how far the leaders are willing to go in their partisanship, and some of the people who were there. And that was good to see.
It's interesting. She says, if somebody asks you, where'd you get my phone number? It's you know, encourage you to say, you know, I got it from a list of registered voters, or, you know, just flat out lie about it.
Also, people are proud.
Fib, I believe, is what she said.
Yeah, they're proud, too. And you're asking them not to be proud.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're proud to be fundamentalists. They're proud to be pursuing their cause. And here this woman was asking them to conduct subterfuge.
Mm-hmm. Or rather go in the closet.
Yeah, exactly.
What did you find interesting about the women speakers? I mean, I find it interesting that there are so many women who are politically involved with this. It seems, again, that there's kind of a dichotomy there, you know.
Well, there was a split, and I spent a lot of time with Myrna Blythe, who is the author of Spin Sisters. And she was the editor of a major women's magazine, and she said that the other editors of the major women's magazines basically condescend to their readers and push a therapeutic culture that makes women feel that they always need help. And she didn't say that the other editors were feminists. She wasn't criticizing them on that ground, but she was criticizing them on a quasi-feminist ground. And she was on a panel with this woman, Jennifer Giroux, who talked about gay parenting as being child abuse, who talked about having 9 children and opposing birth control and
well, at least she put her money where her mouth is.
Yeah, so it was
or we should say
so she was on the same panel with Jennifer Giroux, and afterward I asked her, I was like, well, what do you think? I mean, what did you think of what you heard? And Myrna Blythe was very diplomatic, but she obviously didn't support the positions of Jennifer Giroux. So I was very intrigued by that coalition, that conservative women who are secular conservative women are in support of their conservatism are working in coalition with these women who are very conservative on gender issues.
Mm-hmm.
And that just isn't a choice I could ever make. But that was an apparent split. Also, Young Americans for Freedom were there. There was a young woman from Young Americans for Freedom, which is another secular right-wing group. And I asked her what their position was on abortion and certain kind of hot-button social issues. And she says, we don't take positions on those.
Mm-hmm.
But they are building the coalition. They're
right.
Building that relationship.
Yeah, it's kind of like if you can hold your nose on some of those issues, we can certainly get into bed together and accomplish some issues, you know?
The Quarterly I edit in its next issue that's coming out in December, we have this great article about the way that the economic conservatives at the Heritage Foundation enlisted the Christian right in their campaigns against taxes.
Wow.
Yeah, by shifting their arguments away from supporting the economy to defending families.
Wow.
And how that has become integrated and incorporated in not just the rhetoric, but the politics of the Family Research Council and Concerned Women for America. And if you look at the voter guides of the Christian right now, taxes their evaluation of candidates on taxes totally go down the Republican Party line.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done it through they've presented it to their base through a religious family values lens.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've only got about 2 minutes left, and first of all, I want to thank you, Abby, for spending the time talking with us, because this is really, really interesting stuff. Again, tell us again about the quarterly that you published, The Public Eye.
It's
where people can find it.
It's on some newsstands. Mm-hmm. I don't know, in the Portland area.
I get it in the mail. It's good to have.
Yeah, and people can look at it on the web at www.publiceye.org and subscribe that way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a little more analytical than many progressive publications. We have a mix of scholars and journalists who want to write at a little more deeply,
right,
about their area of expertise. And for instance, we had Michelle Goldberg from Salon.com who covered the last abortion clinic in Mississippi. There's only one left,
mm-hmm.
And how the Christian right basically is trying to close it and not succeeding. And so it is generally on uncovering and helping us understand the right and also our strategies against it.
Great. Well, thanks for talking with us today. We've got to get going here, but I want to, again, direct people to the Public Eye. It's at www.publiceye.org. And the organization, great think tank, Political Research Associates out of Massachusetts. And again, the report that's going to be on their website within the next few days here is called Running Against Sodom and Osama, The Christian Right, Values Voters, and the Culture Wars in 2006. You've got to check them out. And Abby, great job with the editing the Public Eye. It's a great publication, and I encourage everybody to subscribe to it. It's a wonderful thing to get in your mailbox and very, very thoughtful.
Thanks a lot, Pat.
Sure. Thanks, Abby. This has been Boneheads and Bigots. This is Pat McGuire, and we will be talking to you next month.
And here we are back again at Membership Central with some exciting thank yous and some exciting news. First of all, first and foremost, I'd like to thank Laura in Milwaukee for renewing. I'd like to thank Christy in Southeast Portland for renewing. I'd like to thank Ann in Northeast Portland for renewing. I'd like to thank Crystal in Portland, who's a new member. And I'd like to thank Kathy in Southeast Portland, who's a new member. And I think we need a drum roll here, folks, because it is our greatest pleasure to report to you that we have met our overall goal of $175,000. As promised, we are putting this pledge drive to bed. Thank you so much to everyone who has answered the call by making the call. Isn't that right, Brian?
That's right. That's right, Justin. We are so thrilled to have finished out in good style, and only with the help of our listeners, we have met our goal. We met our matching pledge amount the last period of time here, and just remember the frog.
Just remember the frog. Look, there are a couple little things I'd like to say before we go to Democracy Now!, and that's Democracy Now! Uncut, folks, so that's just another reason to celebrate. But we still want all of you to make sure in the near future when you're out and about, we'd like you to come to 20 Southeast 8th and see where all this magic happens. And there's one other thing I'd like to say. We are having a really fantastic party on Tuesday night. That is the Boo Bash, and that will be at the Holocene at 1001 Southeast Morrison, which I have to say is a very cool venue. It reminds me of a very Euro kind of Berlin nightclub. We throw killer parties, and we'd like you to come out. And so, if, even though we have met our goal, if there are a few more of you out there who want to come party with us, a $60 pledge gets you a pair of those tickets still at 232-8818 or 877-500-KABU. With that, we thank everyone in Radio Land around the world who's made this foundation strong for another 6 months. We thank all of our volunteers, all of the restaurants who have made this possible, all of the volunteers, and, of course, most importantly, you out there in Radio Land. It's your station. We gave you your goal, and you made it. So everybody, step back, turn around, and kiss yourself. Now let's go see Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! Uncut.
Thank you, Justin. And yes, it is Democracy Now!, complete, entire, whole, intact. You're listening to KBOO-FM in Portland, Oregon. The time is 4 minutes after 11.
From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
109th Congress is the laziest Congress of all time. I mean, they didn't just break the record for fewest days work, they crushed it by about a month.
The worst Congress ever? Rolling Stone contributing editor Matt Taibbi takes a look at the 109th Congress. Then the New Jersey Supreme Court rules gay couples are entitled to the same legal rights as married heterosexuals. We'll speak with one of the seven gay couples who filed suit. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Amidst rising criticism from Republican ranks and a deepening split with Iraqi leaders, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld has issued a new message to critics of the Iraq War. Back off. At a Pentagon briefing Thursday, Rumsfeld told reporters, quote, "This is complicated stuff. It's difficult. We're looking out into the future. No one can predict the future with absolute certainty. So you ought to just back off, take a look at it, relax, and understand that it's complicated, but it will get worked out," he said. Rumsfeld's comments come as increasing numbers of Republicans are calling for his dismissal. On Wednesday, Republican Senator Olympia Snowe of Maine said President Bush should have accepted Rumsfeld's resignation when it was first offered. Republican Senator Mike DeWine of Ohio and Congressmember Ann Northup of Kentucky also called for Rumsfeld's replacement this week. Northup said, quote, "You cannot afford to lose the numbers we're losing now and just keep slugging away." A U.S. Marine has pleaded guilty to assault and conspiracy in the killing of an unarmed Iraqi in the town of Hamdaniya. The Marine Private First Class John Jotka is the youngest and lowest ranked of the seven charged for the murder of Hashim Ibrahim Awad. The Marine shot Awad after pulling him from his home last April. They initially tried to cover up the slaying by placing a rifle at the scene to give the appearance Awad was an insurgent. In other Iraq news, a senior UN official is warning Iraqi women are facing increasing violence for speaking out. Appearing before the UN Security Council Thursday, UN Development Fund for Women Executive Director Noeline Hazer said women are becoming assassination targets when they affirm women's rights in public decision-making. Hazer also warned of a similar plight for women in Afghanistan and Somalia. Meanwhile, former Chief UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix has issued some of his harshest criticism to date of the Iraq War. In an interview with a Danish newspaper this week, Blix called the war, quote, "a pure failure." Blix says, although Saddam Hussein would still be in power had the U.S. not invaded, quote, "what we've gotten is undoubtedly worse," he said. New details have emerged in the killings of dozens of Afghan civilians by a NATO airstrike earlier this week. Local leaders say the attack occurred in the village of Panjwai. Residents were celebrating the end of the month-long holiday fast of Ramadan. Between 50 to 85 people were slain, most of them women and children. Dozens more were wounded and several homes destroyed in over 4 hours of continuous bombing. At least 20 people were buried in a mass grave. Abdul Ayy, a resident of the near my village, said, quote, "everyone's angry at the government and the coalition. There was no Taliban. These tragedies just keep continuing," he said. In other news, the German military says six people are under investigation over published photographs showing German soldiers desecrating a human skull in Afghanistan. The skull was reportedly taken from a mass grave at least 2 years ago. Four of the six under investigation are longer in the military. The publication of the photographs has sparked outrage in Afghanistan. This is Afghan government spokesperson Sultan Ahmad Bahin.
The government and the people of Afghanistan have been saddened by the news of desecration of human skull by German soldiers in Afghanistan. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Islamic Republic of Afghanistan strongly condemns this action, which goes against Islamic values and Afghan traditions.
In Colombia, the Bush administration has pledged to renew an annual $600 million in military assistance to President Alvaro Uribe. The funding expired last year with the end of the $4 billion Plan Colombia program enacted under the Clinton administration. U.S. Undersecretary of State Nicholas Burns made the announcement in Bogota.
Well, I think, first of all, we want to see a continuation of Plan Colombia, and we're here to discuss with President Uribe and his cabinet how that might be possible, what their own ideas are. We think that the counterterrorism and counter-narcotics efforts have been very successful, but there can be further progress, I think.
U.S. assistance for Colombia has come under criticism from human rights groups who've accused the government-backed paramilitary forces of committing the bulk of atrocities there. U.S. aid has also helped fund a reconciliation plan that's granted amnesty to scores of militants accused of massacres and abuse. At the U.N., a meeting between the foreign ministers of Venezuela and Guatemala has failed to resolve the impasse in their race for an open seat on the U.N. Security Council. Both sides say they'll withdraw their candidacy if they can compromise on a replacement. In an interview with the Reuters news agency Thursday, Venezuelan Foreign Minister Nicolas Maduro said Venezuela would rather lose outright than drop out of the race under pressure from the U.S.
Por primera vez en
For the first time in 16 years since the unipolar world started, the United States has clearly demonstrated they have a fatal obsession against Venezuela. They want to prevent Venezuela from becoming a member of the Security Council.
Maduro went on to say his government has the support of 80% of Latin American and Caribbean countries at the United Nations. Here in the United States, President Bush has signed legislation to build new walling on the border with Mexico. The 700-mile-long barrier would run along parts of California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas. The president held a signing ceremony Thursday at the White House.
Ours is a nation of immigrants. We're also a nation of law. Unfortunately, the United States has not been in complete control of its borders for decades. And therefore, illegal immigration has been on the rise. We have a responsibility to address these challenges. We have a responsibility to enforce our laws. We have a responsibility to secure our borders. We take this responsibility seriously.
Critics are accusing the Bush administration of using the signing ceremony as a political tool to motivate support among anti-immigrant voters. The president already approved $1.2 billion in spending for the wall in a bill signed earlier this month. And limits imposed by Congress call into question whether the money will go towards a physical barrier. Meanwhile, the wall continues to meet vigorous opposition in Mexico. On Thursday, hundreds of demonstrators gathered outside the U.S. Embassy in Mexico City. This is one of the protesters.
We reject the wall because it is a total cancellation of the human rights of the Mexican people, and mainly because we know that the economy of the United States is supported by the efforts of the workers.
Mexican President-elect Felipe Calderón also repeated his government's opposition to the barrier. He spoke Thursday during a visit to Canada.
I would like to repeat that it seems to us a deplorable decision that the United States Congress and the government has made to go ahead and build a wall along the border. Walls do not resolve anything. Humanity made a grave error when a wall was built in Berlin, and I am certain that today the United States has made a grave error in making the decision to construct a wall.
In political news, new polling numbers show a widening lead for Democrats ahead of next month's midterm elections. According to Zogby International, 44% of Americans say they'll vote for Democratic candidates. 33% say they'll vote Republican. Meanwhile, Republican support is dropping among its key base of evangelical Christians. According to the Pew Research Center, 57% of white evangelicals say they'll likely vote Republican this year, a 21-point drop from 2 years ago. As Republican numbers continue to slide, one of the party's leading figures is urging candidates to take voters' focus off the Iraq War. In an interview with the Concord Monitor Tuesday, retiring Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist said, quote, "The challenge is to get Americans to focus on pocketbook issues and not on the Iraq and terror issue." In other election news, Republicans have pulled a Tennessee campaign ad widely criticized for being racially divisive. The 30-second television spot features fictional characters satirizing Democratic Congressmember Harold Ford. Ford is an African-American. He's running for the Senate seat vacated by Majority Leader Bill Frist. Republican National Committee Chair Ken Mellman announced the withdrawal of the advertisement on Thursday. Just days earlier, Mellman insisted he had no authority to take the spot off the air because of campaign finance laws. This news from Guantanamo Bay. The Boston Globe is reporting the Bush administration is renewing a push to impose severe restrictions on how prisoners communicate with their attorneys. The administration wants new rules that would restrict attorney visits, limit mail communication, and control what topics attorneys and prisoners can discuss. The government also wants the military to exert authority over restricting communication rather than leaving it to the courts. In Los Angeles, immigration officials have arrested a former Salvadoran Army officer convicted in the 1989 murders of six Jesuit priests, their housekeeper and her daughter. The convict, Gonzalo Guevara Cerritos, illegally entered the U.S. last year. He'll be deported back to El Salvador. In business news, ExxonMobil has posted another record-setting profit. The oil giant made a third-quarter profit of $10.49 billion. The earnings mark the second-highest total of any publicly traded company in U.S. history, second only to Exxon's own final quarter last year. Some of the nation's leading retailers and clothing brands are being accused of using an abuse-laden factory that employs child labor in Bangladesh. The National Labor Committee says around 200 children are sewing clothing for Hanes, Walmart, JCPenney, and Puma at the factory. Some of the children are younger than 11 years old. The youths told investigators they face routine beatings and work days that extend through the night. Some say they've been paid as little as 6 cents an hour. Charlie Kurgan-Turnigan, the director of the National Labor Committee, said, quote, children belong in school, not locked in sweatshops. Walmart, Hanes, and the other companies owe these children, he said. In media news, owners of the radio giant Clear Channel Communications are in talks to take the company private. The company could fetch up to $18.5 billion from a group of investors. Clear Channel currently owns more than 1,200 radio stations across the country and could own more pending media ownership proposals currently before the FCC. And finally, the private mercenary company Blackwater has hired former independent counsel and Whitewater investigator Kenneth Starr in its defense against a wrongful death lawsuit brought by families of four employees killed in Iraq. The news is revealed in a new piece in the Nation website by Democracy Now! Correspondent and Nation fellow Jeremy Scahill, entitled From Whitewater to Blackwater. The families are suing Blackwater for wrongful death over its alleged failure to provide adequate protection to contractors killed in the Iraqi city of Fallujah in March of 2004. Kenneth Starr has played a prominent role in Blackwater's attempts to have the case dismissed or moved to federal court, where it would have a higher likelihood of being heard by Republican appointees. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. With just over a week left to Election Day, the mainstream media is focusing on...